Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here on the big program, healthcard.gov, up and running. Or so they're telling us. We're going to find out if it's running the full capacity and what we need to do to make sure, hey, we get that health insurance. Also, who's to blame when someone's unemployed? Is it your fault? Is it my fault? Is it the drugs? Is it the laziness? The sloth indifference? We're going to talk about the unemployed and how different groups handle unemployment. And, of course, who's to blame? Tom Corbett says it's the drugs. So it's lazy people. Republicans say, well, you know, it's that unemployment makes people lazy. Yeah. Also, some interesting poll numbers out for the 2016 senatorial race. Yes, yes, folks, we are in perpetual campaign mode. The day you're elected, you're running for re-election, even if it is six years down the road. And we're going to talk about corporate America, Walmart, and the, well, who's keeping tabs on you? Do you know? Do you care? We're going to find out. Also going to take your calls, your thoughts, your comments, questions, whatever is on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or send me an email, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So there was Thankless Thursday. Did you get out on Thankless Thursday? How about Black Friday? Did you brave the sales? 5 o'clock in the morning out there, bustling and fighting and the reality series that was very entertaining. In fact, I'm waiting for fake news on Fox. I'm waiting for Fox to come out with a new reality show year round so we can have Black Friday year round. You know, the shootings, the stabbings, the beatings, the stompings, the chokings, and even a taser thrown in for good measure. Oh, the joy. Oh, the wonder of the season. Tis the season to be jolly. My favorite, there was the stompings and the shootings and all of that stuff. Lots of really, really interesting stories, like the person who bought the TV at Target in Las Vegas and was, you know, all excited to take it home, then got robbed on the way home, dropped the TV and was shot. Not only shot, TV probably broken too. Another one of my favorite ones, police, said that, you know, a girl got trampled at a Walmart, as the door is bust open. You know, people trampled the 11-year-old. And nothing like, you know, I know it's all about the children, but nothing like trampling the children. And, you know, the stories go on. According to BlackFridayDeathCount.com, and yes, there is a BlackFridayDeathCount.com, seven deaths, seven people across the country in this joyous season of Christmas. You know, there's a war on Christmas, don't you know? And seven, that's, you know, it's a number, and, you know, the... Some just have to be sacrificed for the greater good, right? For the you know, the save 20% on something. Yeah, seven dead. Merry Christmas to your seven families. 90 injured. And those are just the reports that we know about. I'm sure that number will grow as the days and weeks go. So I'll continue to follow Black Friday death count. Seven people killed. Can you believe that? And I look at this and I go, you know, is it worth it? Was it worth saving a couple of bucks on some? I did not go out. I did not go out on Thursday as a matter of principle. Did not go out on Friday as a matter of there's nothing I need that badly that I'm willing to be crowded in a room fighting with other people over what? A thing? Now, according to the National Retail Federation, they say that this time of the year, this season, accounts for a good majority of the retail industry's yearly funding. You know, they're the ones that are saying, look, you know, accounts for about 20 to 40% of the retailer's annual sales. Thanksgiving weekend alone represents about 10 to 15% of those holiday sales. So you look at this, you go, oh, it's a huge slice. So why not? Why not get out there and try and beat the next guy by being open a couple minutes early, by being a couple hours earlier? Wall Street Journal reports holiday sales sagged despite blitz of deals, discounts, earlier opening hours fail to pry more dollars out of budget conscious shoppers. So even the little danglies they put in front of our face didn't go for it. New York Times, Thanksgiving opening takes sales from Black Friday. Duh. Did you think that you were going to add new consumption? And this is the part that gets me. People have X amount of dollars to spend. This was all about, understand, this was all about certain retail chains saying, well, if we can just screw the next guy a little quicker, and we're willing to screw our workers to do it, we're willing to put them at peril, we're willing to put their families at inconvenience. And I know, I heard all the stories. Oh, the stories. Our workers want to work on Thanksgiving. They're really excited. Yeah. Yeah. And then there was small business Saturday and hungover Sunday and then Cyber Monday. Last year there was $1.5 billion in online sales from desktop computers on Cyber Monday. This Cyber Monday they were hoping online sales would hit about $2 billion. We will find out. That would include mobile online as well. The mobile sales as well. A record 248 million people were expected to get out into the stores and shop over the Thanksgiving 4-day fest. Up from 247 million people, according to the National Retail Federation. 25 million people are expected to use their mobile devices. Up 22% from last year. And I gotta ask you, did you go out on Cyber Monday? Did you get online? Did you do the whole thing? Because if you did, I hope your spyware was up to date. And if you used mobile apps, I hope you did so with caution. Disabled your Bluetooth. Don't use the public wireless. In fact, block that because you don't want them tracking you where you're going. Yeah. Know who the merchants are online. Don't click on pop-ups. I know some people do that. I stay away from it. But on Cyber Monday, did you do it? And I got to go back. Was it worth it? I mean, I look at all this. Was it worth it? Was all of the war on Thanksgiving, was it worth it? Because they actually said that spending fell compared to last year. Fell about 2.7%. And what's 2.7%? About $57 billion. They're saying that the number of people who showed up at the stores on Black Friday was down more than 11%. Now, okay, so your Black Friday attendance down 11%, sales were down 13%. Where'd that go? Oh, yeah, it was up on Thanksgiving Day. Why? Like I said, the spending simply went on a different day. You didn't add new spending. Now, I guess you could make the argument, well, we did it because, well, we wanted to make sure nobody got trampled in the parking lot. They did. And according to the Black Friday death count, there were several stabbings over parking spaces. There were injuries, all over the place of, hey, that's mine. No, mine. This is my favorite video is the woman who just walks by these three or four women who are just brawling in the middle of the store. And it was hysterical. And this woman just walks by and reaches down, tases the woman on the ground, walks away. You got to love the fellowship of the season, don't you? So I guess tonight I'll ask you, did you go out and what did you experience? What did you see as you were out there fighting for deals? And did the war on Thanksgiving, did it matter to you? Did it matter that that maybe we're seeing the end of one more family day? Maybe this is the end of it. Now, the war on Christmas rages on, according to the American Family Association. They have put out their naughty or nice list of friends of Christmas and enemies of Christmas. And oddly enough, as you go down the list of companies that the American Family Association says are good companies for Christmas, the good family values companies, oddly enough, a lot of them, the Walmart, the Kmart's, a lot of them, they were open on Thanksgiving. And you just, the Office Max, you go down the list and you go, there's a lot of these, really? JCPenney's, these are the good companies, good Christian. They're the ones who will say Merry Christmas. They're not going to go with that cheap week, happy holidays, no, no. And then they got a list of companies that are marginal on Christmas. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. Like 1-800-Flowers.com, marginal. Bath and Body Works, Best Buy, all marginal. And then Then there's the naughty list. That's right. The companies that are against Christmas. They're the companies who hate Christmas. Barnes & Noble, Family Dollar, Foot Locker, Limited Brands, Maurice's, not quite sure what Maurice's is, Office Depot, PetSmart. In fact, Radio Shack should be boycotted. Completely boycotted them, according to the Lulus at the American Family Association. Staples, Super Value, and Victoria's Secrets, all anti-Christmas. And I'm going, really? Anti-Christmas? You know, these are the people who you know, kind of think that there might be somebody else out there who may not be Christian, who may not celebrate Christmas, but hey, maybe buying stuff anyway. And this is what gets me about the people at, like the American Family Association. It's all about them. Total intolerance to any other ideas or any other thoughts. It's either got to be their way or the highway. Look, I don't care if you say Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever. Whatever it is your deal is, bless you. Do what you got to do. Happy holidays. Can't we just be happy with you? Because I look at the Black Friday death count, and I got to ask, Merry Christmas? Really? Did you see anything that said Merry Christmas this past weekend? Drivers were more erratic, more aggressive, more angry. This weekend, on the weekends, I go out and one day a week I drive a truck just to, A, keep into it, and I like driving. Keep my CDL active and all of that. So, you know, on Sunday I went out and I took a road trip. What normally took 11 hours took me 13 and a half. And I got to be honest, I don't think I've ever had as many angry looks, dagger stares, one finger salutes, as I did on Sunday. On Sunday! Now, this is the Lord's Day of the Lord's time of the year, when we're all supposed to be a little happier, a little nicer. The smiles are a little more willing. We're more willing to lend out a helping hand. And I go on Saturday, you know, in the heart of this, you got the actor, Walker, I think his name was, killed in a car crash where people took video. Got to get it up on YouTube. But I didn't see anybody running to help. And I got to ask, you know, the war on Christmas is nonsense of this ridiculous, well, you didn't say the words. What about the acts? What about the deeds? What about just being a decent human being? What we have turned this holiday into, and really every day, it's not just this holiday. It's every day. It's hooray for me, screw you. I'm going to slit your throat before you get me. That's what these people have put, the situations that they've put us in. I got cut off about six times by the same guy trying to get one car length ahead of me. I mean, we're in traffic for an hour trying to get 2 miles. And the guy's back and forth because he's just in a tizzy and in a rush. And you go, really? Is this the meaning of the season? And all I could keep thinking to myself was, 'tis the season to be jolly. And I would smile and wave. Sad stuff. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back and talk about the healthcare.gov website, is it up? Is it fixed? Is it ready? Will it go? We'll find out after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We want the world.
Right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Workers in 100 cities are expected to strike on Thursday as part of the national fast food workers movement that began in 2012 with workers at fast food restaurants in New York City walking off their jobs to demand better wages. Fast food workers in every region of the continental U.S. will walk off their jobs Thursday in the Fight for 15 movement, a demand for at least a $15 an hour minimum wage and the right to form unions, without employer retaliation. Supporters of this fast food worker movement will also rally in 100 additional U.S. cities. Worker strikes will include McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and KFC. It's the latest chapter in the escalating low-wage worker struggle to win living wages and real union organizing rights nationwide.
Fast for Families is a 21-day fast aimed at stressing the moral impacts of the Republican U.S. House leadership's failure to act on immigration reform. Fast for Families is supported by thousands of advocates and organizations. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama visited the Fast for Families tent on the National Mall over the Thanksgiving weekend in a show of support. Three people have been on a fast for 21 days, and a three-day National Days of Act, Fast, and Pray event in solidarity with the Fast for Families began on Monday. A special event and press conference about the fasting is set for today in Washington, D.C. North Carolina's Forward Together Moral Movement is launching informational pickets at stores owned by Art Pope. Pope is North Carolina's budget director, and the Forward Together movement is picketing Pope-owned stores because of Pope's support for what the movement says is the extremist and regressive direction of North Carolina government policy. Pope has backed moves to deny Medicaid expansion to 500,000 people in North Carolina and to cut unemployment benefits for 170,000 people. The North Carolina NAACP also says Pope has been involved in voter suppression legislation and helped develop a budget with devastating cuts to public education. The NAACP says stores owned by Art Pope are in predominantly African-American, poor, and working-class communities. The picketing campaign wants to raise awareness of Pope's actions and demand a reversal of the policies that he supports. After 8 long years of struggle, graduate employees at New York University now have a neutrality agreement with NYU in a union election that will be held December 10th and 11th. NYU agrees to stay neutral in the union election and respect the results. 1,247 grad employees will be able to vote. If the United Auto Workers wins the election, collective bargaining rights for the grad student workers will be restored. A new contract could be in place by the end of the academic year. UAW Region 9A Director Julie Kushner says the tenacity of the workers over this 8-year struggle to win back their collective bargaining rights is inspiring, and the UAW is proud to have stood with the workers. The NYU grad student workers lost their collective bargaining rights after a decision by the George W. Bush-appointed National Labor Relations Board allowed NYU to refuse to bargain a second contract. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So just in time for Cyber Monday, the Obama administration said on Sunday that it had met its goal for improving healthcare.gov. The website, they say, now will work smoothly for the vast majority of users. Basically, the administration said, yeah, passing grade, thumbs up, we're moving forward, all right. And Sunday evening, the site had allowed more than 300,000 people to log in, do their business. On that day, according to someone familiar with it in the administration. Number of people that at the site higher than that they had it previously. Reports, you know, some improvements, greater speed, things looking in the right direction. They're saying that the average user spent about 20 to 30 minutes on the site and that the site will now support some 800,000 customers each and every day, which from now till the first, good news to hear. Here to talk about this and what we do if we encounter some problems, Athena Ford. She's Advocacy Director for the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Athena, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So healthcare.gov fixed.
Mostly, and that's exciting. A lot of folks that were having trouble getting access to healthcare before are able now to go onto the site, navigate it super easily, get enrolled into coverage. I was talking to somebody today whose brother was able to go onto healthcare.gov and find himself affordable coverage and enroll right away. So this is exciting. Folks still have, though, until now, they pushed it back December 23rd to enroll so that it takes effect January 1st.
Good. You know, the thing to me is, you know, I look at the Republicans who are crying these crocodile tears and all, they care so much now. Even though they had, 60, 70, 100 votes to repeal it, now they seem to care. Does it make a lot of sense to you?
No, not at all. And the other thing is, nobody's going to deny. I mean, I was frustrated. I think it's understandable that it was frustrating that the website didn't work the way it should on day one. But as I'm traveling across the state talking to people who haven't been able to get the health care they need, they're not telling me that they're frustrated. They're telling me, yeah, you know, it would be cool if it worked now, but if I have to wait a couple more weeks to finally get health care coverage with all of this help, with all of this tax credits and all these subsidies, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, to me, I look at the website, and again, my take on it is unlike any that I've heard anyone say. This is an example of a public-private partnership gone awry. This is what happens when you have privatization and you have a brain drain of government and you have this starve-the-beast mentality. When you have 55 private for-profit corporations with their finger in the pie, each with their own special interest, to me, you could have predicted you were going to have these problems.
Yeah. The whole operation obviously could have been rolled out a little bit more smoothly. But as you said, it's exciting that it's working better now, and the folks are finally able to get access to coverage.
You know, you told a story a moment ago about somebody that you knew who had signed up, and I've got my own. I had breakfast not too long ago with a woman who had a whole slew of pre-existing conditions and was in the high-risk pool that she couldn't afford and all of this stuff. And as she's talking, she said, I'm able to sign up for health care, and I was able to navigate the system. It took me a while, but for $70 every other week, I'm going to have health care. And then she literally broke out into tears. And, you know, I'm sitting there going, you know, it's not until I saw that, until you see things like that, that you really understand what this means to people.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, yeah, it's life and death, but then there's also just the everyday. There's the something's wrong now, but can I go to the doctor? Should I just hope that it's okay? Should I just put it off? What's going to end up happening to me if I do that? I mean, to just be able to know I'm sick, I can get the care I need, and my whole family's not going to go into bankruptcy because of it.
Yeah.
It's such a relief.
And, you know, I think about it, and, you know, all of the talk recently over these cancellations, and look, did the president know they were going to happen? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Was it predictable? Probably, when you're talking about a number of plans out there that are probably crummy plans that you didn't need. Fortunately, you lucked out and got through it. But those crummy plans are going away. So there's a part of me that goes, okay, you knew that. But you know what's not going to be in this? The cancellation notice once you get sick, because there's rescission. Which, until this whole debate, I don't think but a handful of people in this country knew what rescission was.
Oh, you're right. You know who didn't know, though, was women who had breast cancer. Because there were insurance companies, believe it or not, that would target women who had breast cancer, whose cancer had gone into remission. Oftentimes, these women had reached their lifetime limits, and they have a pre-existing condition, so they're left uninsurable. They would sell them a policy. But then if the cancer returned, they would pull the coverage and say, well, we didn't know you had acne. You didn't tell us you had headaches. You're now uninsured.
So walk me back through this for people who may not, because there may be some people who don't know the practice of rescission. Because to me, that's the cancellation notice that I don't want to get. If you're going to cancel my policy by saying, you know what, the plan you've been buying all these years is crappy, and, you know, you were getting kind of screwed on it, but you weren't paying a lot for it, you had a false sense of security, I guess I could be okay with that. But if I end up with cancer and I get a cancellation notice, I think I would have more of a problem.
Yeah. And it's obviously, it's terrifying. That's where we find a lot of the families who end up going into medical bankruptcy or going into medical bankruptcy, they had health insurance. It was because they reached their lifetime limit or because their health insurance company pulled the coverage when they got sick and said some kind of BS excuse like I just gave you. The healthcare law has now made this illegal. The only way an insurance company can take your coverage away from you is if they can prove you were actually trying to commit fraud when you signed up. So if you say, no, I don't smoke, but really you smoke, I mean, that's, you know, you're committing fraud
right
in that case. But if it's just something silly, like you had acne or something crazy like that, they can't take your coverage away from you.
Because, you know, as I remember this, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but these insurance companies actually had teams who would comb through your history. And there were actually bonuses paid by how much these teams would save by denying someone coverage. I mean, that's how bad, from the stories, how bad it had gotten.
Finding ways to deny people access to health care was built into the industry, just like you said. There were teams of people who did it. There was a whole market efficiency plan built around it. And that's how you end up with these institutions that are supposed to help people get access to a doctor actually helping themselves making billions and billions in profits.
Yeah. Let me ask you, before the Republicans had this grand epiphany and began caring about people getting cancellation notices, they now seem to care. And, you know, good.
Yeah.
I'm glad. It's the holiday season. We should care a lot more. I can empathize a little bit. But where were they when Tom Corbett gave 41,000 low-wage workers here in Pennsylvania a cancellation notice when he dumped adult basic? Where were the Republicans when Scott Walker in Wisconsin booted 100,000 low-wage workers off of their Badger care? Where was all this empathy and concern and all of this outrage and all of this soapbox talk when low-wage workers throughout this country in states run by Republican governors and legislatures were gutting their low-wage health care plans? Where was that then?
Here, here. Or when 60,000 kids were kicked off of the rolls of Medicaid here in Pennsylvania a couple years ago. It's overwhelming. It's been an outrageous work of policies, like you're saying, some of these opposition leaders canceling coverage, walking away from it, and then at the same time saying, oh, this law here that's going to help people get access to it, this is this evil thing. And so that's why organizations like mine are going around and saying, hey, folks, if you got coverage because of this healthcare law, if your plan was canceled and now you're finding that you're actually eligible for real insurance that's actually going to cover you when you get sick, we want to know, we want to hear those stories, and we want to be able to share them with the public, because these kinds of attacks against the healthcare law are going to keep coming, so we need to keep standing up against them.
The attacks are easy. You shouldn't make me buy anything. If I want my crummy plan, I should be able to have it. But you don't hear the stories like you're saying. I don't see enough of the other side of this. Hey, you know, I had this crummy plan. It didn't cover anything like the adult basic. It was 4 visits a year that you could get. Now I've got a plan that actually, when I get sick, I can go to the doctor and it doesn't cost me much. Why aren't we hearing more of those stories? And there's part of me thinks it's, you know, that maybe people don't want to be seen by the public. I'm not quite sure how that goes.
I mean, I think it's part of a couple different things. There's a problem when it comes to disengagement in the democratic process overall. I think it's trouble getting those stories in the news media. I think sometimes, obviously, the Rick Smith Show, fabulous exception, but sometimes it's hard to get people to cover this side of the story. And then I think it's your health care. It's a very personal issue that, and I have a lot of respect for those people that are willing to work with me and stand up and talk about this kind of a thing publicly, because I understand that it's a private thing. But when you're talking about the cancellations, did you know that Pennsylvania was one of the last states left that didn't mandate that insurance companies had to cover maternity coverage? So a woman could buy herself a policy, or a man, and, you know, somebody in the family then gets pregnant and needs to get to a doctor, and that just wouldn't be covered. And most of us don't even think about that. We don't even think that, oh, an insurance policy would cover maternity coverage until you get pregnant and you need it. So these are the kinds of reasons that policies are being canceled right now, is because from now on, everybody needs to know that when you're buying insurance, you're buying a quality product.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it, as we're having this conversation and I see more of this stuff, the education, because I've been very fortunate, and I'll be the first to admit it, for the vast majority of my working life, I have had a union job that had you know, the Cadillac healthcare plans. I never had to worry about anything or pay for really anything. I mean, maybe $10 when you go to the doctor, or $5 when you get a prescription or something. But beyond that, everything was covered. You know, when my children were born, they didn't even send me a bill. So very, very fortunate. And knowing that I'm very fortunate in this, I think everyone should have that security that I have, that my family has. And I guess my problem is I'm not one of those people who say, I made it up the ladder, now I'm going to kick the ladder off the side of the building so no one follows me. I think everyone should have that kind of, not only health security, but also economic security.
Yeah, and you know what? Reassuring for me is that actually the majority of Pennsylvanians and the majority of Americans agree with you. The majority of people feel like if somebody gets sick, they should have the security of knowing they can go to a doctor when they need to without facing huge, enormous medical bills and be able to get the treatment that they need. This is actually something that a lot of people agree on. And the hope is that with the rollout of the healthcare law, more people will have access to it. I mean, we need to remember that there's still a huge chunk. There's about 400,000 people for whom this isn't going to be a reality on January 1st.
Let me ask you this. You know, we're in one of the states where the governor has refused to expand Medicaid. We're in one of the states where the exchanges haven't been set up. Would this have gone smoother had you had, like Pennsylvania or other states, Texas or other states, say, you know, we're going to set up our own exchange because we believe in states' rights. We're states' rights type people. We're going to set up our own thing. We're going to do our own thing. We're going to enroll people. Do you think it would have been a much smoother transition, much easier to get done, other than relying on what? How many uninsured do we have in the country? 50 million uninsured rushing to a website all at once? I mean, there's part of me that goes, that should have been an easier lift.
Oh, that's, yeah, undeniably. It was interesting, you know, the administration held a couple hearings before the health care law was implemented in Pennsylvania, and they asked industry representatives, the folks from insurance companies, to come out, and then people like myself that represent individuals, and to talk about what should happen with the marketplace here in Pennsylvania. And as I'm sure you can imagine, we disagreed on just about everything, except the one issue that we all came together on and said is Pennsylvania should run its own marketplace. It would make it so much easier. It would make it a simpler process for folks to enroll. And it would let us tailor it in a way that works well for the healthcare systems in our state. And it would also mean that if something goes wrong, it's a quick fix. We don't have to wait for the federal government to go through and push through new regulations and whatever it is, that whole process. We could just, bam, fix it here on the ground. And, of course, it's the one thing that we ended up not doing.
Yeah. You know, but, and the other part of this is, you know, I guess just because I'm not a techie kind of person, I think we relied too heavily on a website. I think had we had offices like unemployment offices or welfare offices or any offices still open, I mean, it's been a very successful fight against public sector workers and starve the beast kind of government mentality, that we've closed down all of these places where people could actually go and sign up on a piece of paper with somebody who could help guide them through. Because I think a lot of people like me, I went to the website, I don't know where to go with it.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you look at a state like Maryland, nowhere near as big as Pennsylvania, they're working with $24 million over there, and they've got people on the ground, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're setting up little offices in all these different communities, and they're educating and enrolling folks. And in Pennsylvania, something like $3 million for the entire state that we have to educate and enroll individuals.
Wow.
So there's this effort, again, because we chose to go with the federal model and not institute our own state exchange where we could have raised the money on the exchange to do more of that stuff, we're really missing out here. But for your listeners who are tuning in right now and thinking, yeah, I wish I could go talk to somebody in person, the best way to do that is to go to localhelp.healthcare.gov. That's local help, H-E-L-P, not local health. It's local help, all one word, .healthcare.gov. And then they can go there and they can just type in their zip code, and all of the what's called navigators or certified application counselors in their area, they're just both terms for people that can help them enroll, will show up. One thing to watch out for, something that we lost the fight on, is that insurance companies can actually become certified application counselors.
Great.
So just, it's not a deal, but just, you know, just to flag that for folks. If you look at it and you see that it's a social service agency, it's your church, it's your library, probably somebody you can trust. If it's Blue Cross, maybe you want to go somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it's like sending Little Red Riding Hood over to the Big Bad Wolf's house.
Yeah, something like it.
Or get information from you folks, the great work you guys do at the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Last question I've got for you, in looking at this, you know, what advice do you give to people who've gone to the site, you know, they're just kind of frustrated? I know you said the help site, just a little kind of words of encouragement.
Right. I mean, the thing to remember is you have until the end of March to enroll in coverage, and you have until December 23rd if you want it to take effect on that very first day on January 1st. So you still have a couple of months. We'll get it together. You can go to the site now and you can look at the plans that are available. But just when you see the prices show up, remember that over nearly 900,000 Pennsylvanians are going to qualify for help to pay for that price. So you're likely that's not going to be the price you end up paying. So you can still shop around. You can figure out what it is you want. I would suggest The website's been working a lot better. I'd suggest giving it another go. And if you're a little gun-shy, that's understandable. Go to localhealth.healthcare.gov and hook up with a navigator or a certified application counselor and have them enroll you. Or, you know, you can call the 1-800 number. You can have a navigator call on your behalf. Sometimes it's always good to have an advocate do that. There's a lot of other ways to enroll. And, again, go to pahealthaccess.org and reach out to us if none of this is working. We are a certified application counselor. Promise you, we're somebody you can trust. We're not going to try to sell you anything. And we are happy to help people with this process as well.
All right. Well, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us, Athena. Thanks so much, and thanks for the work you do.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thanks for all the issues you're highlighting.
Thanks so much. Athena Ford, Advocacy Director at the Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Of course, their website, pahealthaccess.org. We've got links to the websites at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. For working people, from the top.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Coca-Cola is running a stealth advertising campaign. Stealth? Why would a corporation as ad-dependent as Coke spend big bucks on advertising that it doesn't want consumers to notice? Shh. Because the campaign is a surreptitious ploy to enlist restaurants in a marketing conspiracy that targets you, your children, and, of course, your wallet. Coke calls its covert gambit Tap the Tap, urging restaurateurs to stop offering plain old tap water to customers. Quote, every time your business fills a cup or a glass with tap water, it pours potential profits down the drain. Tap the Tap can put a stop to that, says Coke, by teaching your crew members or wait staff suggestive selling techniques to convert requests for tap water into orders for revenue-generating beverages. The program provides a guide for restaurant managers who would direct Coke's customer assault, a backroom poster to remind wait staff, quote, when and how to suggestively sell beverages, and a participant's guide to put suggestive selling foremost in the mind as staff confronts the enemy, customers. Tactics include outflanking those recalcitrant customers who insist on water. Just switch the sales pitch to bottled water. Remember, Coca-Cola owns Dasani, one of the top-selling brands of bottled water in the U.S. Early in its Cap the Tap scheme, the beverage behemoth offered two incentive programs for waitstaff, Suggest More and Score, and Get Your Fill. Both were competitions to spur servers to push more Coke on American restaurant goers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Coke's CEO has declared that, quote, obesity is today's most challenging health issue, and solving it requires all of us doing our part. Really? By selling more Coke? That's proof that hypocrisy is now the official rocket fuel of corporate profits.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor. I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, so I asked that question, you know, where all of this, this outrage, all of the, you know, the up on the soapbox saying, oh, I care about those poor people who got their policies canceled. You know, where were they when Corbett was kicking 41,000 low-wage workers off of adult basic, a plan that they were contributing to? And really, a crummy plan at that. Four doctor visits a year? Really? But it was something. Booted them to the curb. Wanted to get them into plans that, and, you know, I guess you could make the argument that maybe they were a very small tad, better, maybe just a little, but at four times the cost. I didn't hear the Republicans really on any side of the issue other than cancel them. Same thing with Walker in Wisconsin. 100,000 people booted, canceled, done. Where were they then? Oh, well, don't really care about that, do we? Now, understand, there are some things about this law I'm not fond of, things that we will make better into the future, but as it stands, getting people health care is not a bad thing. And this law, if we give it a chance, I mean, you know, I liken it a lot to Medicare. You go back and you read all of the arguments against Medicare. You go back and I was watching the old reruns of the Munsters with my kids. And there was Paul Lynn playing a doctor in one of the episodes, complaining about how Medicare was going to put him out of business. The moneyed interest at the time didn't want it. Why do we want these people to have help? Let them die if they can't afford to pay for it. And now you got people who they'll beat you with their cane if you try and take their Medicare away, as they should. And the reality is the vast majority of us wanted the law to go forward, to give it a chance to work, and fix what goes wrong. Don't stand here. It's done. That ship sailed, right? Ship sailed. Supreme Court said constitutional. Your 100 repeal votes have done nothing but cause division and waste time when we could have been saying, okay, well, this is something I specifically don't like. Let's change this. If they had taken those 100 votes or how many ever it was and said, this is what I don't like, let's debate this, I'd have been okay with it. But this whole idea of repeal and replace, well, okay, replace it with what? Your plan of pay or die doesn't work. Sorry. Next idea. Come up with an idea. Show me something. Now, you've got states like Pennsylvania. Maybe, I guess we're still rejecting the Medicaid expansion, which really could have a major influx of revenue into the state, create some 40,000 jobs, secure some of our hospitals in needy areas, and maybe get one in Perry County. I didn't realize until this whole thing went on that Perry County doesn't actually have a health care system. It's basically you're on your own. And thanks to this law, they're going to get something, because if you've got an insurance card and you're paying premiums or something, you're going to want to be able to go somewhere, right? And I go back to this whole thing of rescission. You know, with all these cancellations, people are all worked up. Think about this for a second. And I know the vast majority of people didn't know this actually happened. Now that the law's in effect, can't happen anymore. It's illegal. They would set up teams. Let's say I got sick and I got some form of cancer. What they would do is they would go back through my history. They would have a team, and their job would be to look at everything that I've done, all of the things that I've been involved in, and they would comb through my past with a fine-tooth comb. And if I didn't say, you know, this happened on the form, they would say, well, you lied on your form. We're canceling your policy, and we're canceling it right now. So you have nothing. And good luck going to find coverage when you've been diagnosed with cancer, because now you got a pre-existing condition. Now nobody's going to cover you. How beautiful is that? Now, you know, I go back and I think about, you know, in the work that I've done over the years, and I know a lot of people, think about your own lives for a second. Think about some of the, you know, I worked on shipping docks. We dealt with hazardous material all the time. In fact, You know, there were times when some of it would spill, and you, for a minute, you'd inhale some of it as you were going by. Carcinogens. You were exposed to. You didn't put that on the form. Well, you know, what? Canceled. And then what they would do, the most perverted part of all this, is these teams who would comb through your past, if they found it and they were able to cancel you, they would give the team a bonus based on how much they had saved the company. And, of course, how much they got from you. I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, just completely outrageous. So for me, I say we fix what's wrong, we move forward, we make sure every person has access to the best health care possible. We get affordable health insurance that actually has good coverage, and we go forward so that all of us have the same kind of health security and more, and just as important, economic security. Yeah, because I've told this story a couple of times, but doing this program, I met a woman who both of her daughters had a rare form of leukemia. And, you know, they thought they were living the American dream. They had a nice house. Both of them had really good college-educated professional jobs, making a good living, with both of them with health care. Then the girls get sick. Long story, really short, broke, bankrupt, no insurance because they'd reached their caps. Daughter's still sick. Bankrupt, lost everything. Because they thought their policy would cover it. For me, that's part of this as well. It is that simple. And if we repeal it now, we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for it big in a system that collapses. Just what it is. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Get up and take your money. All they want to do is.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
I've been knocking on the door that holds the throne. I've been looking for the map that leads me home. I've been somewhere on good hearts turn to stone. The road of intentions is going dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
The road to good intentions is turned to stone. What great song lyrics, man. I think this weekend really for me highlighted that. I mean, you look at it's supposed to be the beginning of a time of the year where we smile a little easier, we're nicer to each other, the giving season. And man, I hope it gets better from this point on out. I just do. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you got something on your mind, you can call us 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or email me rick@therickSmithShow.com. Brian sent me a little note during the break. He says, like you, I've been fortunate to have great union health care throughout my working life. I agree, everyone should have the same coverage I have. He says, we hear all the time that people with health care will abuse it. I use it when I'm sick, and that's it. I write to tell you I appreciate your honesty, and I appreciate the program. Thanks for what you do. I appreciate it, Brian. Thanks for the email. And look, I'm the same way. I've got this great health care, and I use it only when I'm sick. And even then, my producer, Brett, was reminding me of when I had my gallbladder problems and I was writhing on the floor in pain for like 20 minutes, going, I'm not going to the doctor. Well, during the one show, I made it about 45 minutes while, basically just writhing in pain. And, as soon as it was over, I then went to the doctor because I couldn't take it anymore. But, and this whole idea that, well, if you have it, you'll abuse it is ridiculous. Just completely ridiculous. But for me, and I think about this often, over the weekend I was, something just popped into my head. I'm helping finish up the book from the People's Tour for America. I'm writing the conclusion part of it. And I was thinking about when I was a kid. And, we lived in a housing project. It was really a crummy neighborhood. I mean, it was horrible. And I wish that on no one. And I wish, I wish better opportunity for everyone. But I was thinking about this, the people who lived next to us. It was a black family, a woman and three kids. And then I don't know if it was the boyfriend or the husband, but he was intermittently in and out because when you're on welfare, you couldn't have a man living in the house, which is another one of those insane things at the time that just welfare was just stupid on. But, he didn't have a job. And as I was thinking about it over the weekend, as I was writing this, I remember when he got a job at Ford, a good paying union job at Ford. I forget what he did, but I remember that our little block of several buildings all put together had a little party because, this is a great celebration for everybody. Because somebody's going to get out. Because I was remembering, who got out of my neighborhood? Well, occasionally an athlete got out, but that was for a short period of time. Occasionally young people would go off to the military, but they generally came back. Because understand, we're talking about the early 70s. And then there were the people who got union jobs. And I was thinking about this, as I'm writing, I'm going, when I was a kid, union jobs meant opportunity. And I was thinking about the whole progression. I remember when they got a car. It wasn't a great car, but it meant that the guy didn't have to walk 3.5-4 miles to the Ford factory anymore. he could drive. And then I remember, you know, the kids had better shoes and the kids had better clothes. And they bought a new bike. The three kids got, you know, a new bike. And then eventually all three of them had bikes. And there was all of this snowball of, you know, as money was coming in, they were making their lives better. But the one thing that stopped me and made me stop typing and just sit back and go, wow, they had food at the end of the month. And you go, you know, I think back at this now, and for me it was one of those just stopping moments. And if you've never been in this situation, and I hope you never have, I hope nobody ever has, where you go the last week of the month, the last couple of days of the month, where there is literally nothing in the house. Nothing at all in the house. The mice are going, hey, you know, where's the stuff? I remember the family next to us. At the end of the month, they had dinner. And it wasn't anything great. It was a normal dinner like you'd have maybe at the beginning of the month. And they would invite people from the neighborhood over because they knew that the neighborhood was struggling. And it was that kind of community. And it just caught me that by this guy getting this union job, a good paying job with decent wages and decent health care and decent benefits, that they could afford to have. And it sounds like such a small thing, that they could have food in the cupboards the entire month. And maybe it's just a little thing to me, but that's, to me, when I think about it, that's really what that union job meant. That's really what that good paying job meant. Aside from, you know, you go with the opportunity, the hand of the middle class, all of that stuff. Something as simple and as basic as being able to take care of yourself and make sure that you got a roof over your head and food on the table and clothes on your back. You know, the dignity that comes with that, the self-respect. And it just stuck with me. Just one of those things. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you download the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Take the program with you on the go. Going to come right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Workers in 100 cities are expected to strike on Thursday as part of the National Fast Food Workers Movement that began in 2012 with workers at fast food restaurants in New York City walking off their jobs to demand better wages. Fast food workers in every region of the continental U.S. will walk off their jobs Thursday in the Fight for 15 movement, a demand for at least a $15 an hour minimum wage and the right to form unions without employer retaliation. Supporters of this fast food worker movement will also rally in 100 additional U.S. cities. Worker strikes will include McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and KFC. It's the latest chapter in the escalating low-wage worker struggle to win living wages and real union organizing rights nationwide. Fast for Families is a 21-day fast aimed at stressing the moral impacts of the Republican U.S. House leadership's failure to act on immigration reform. Fast for Families is supported by thousands of advocates and organizations. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama visited the Fast for Families tent of the National Mall over the Thanksgiving weekend in a show of support. Three people have been on a fast for 21 days, and a three-day National Days of Act, Fast, and Pray event in solidarity with the Fast for Families began on Monday. A special event and press conference conference about the fasting is set for today in Washington, D.C. North Carolina's Forward Together Moral Movement is launching informational pickets at stores owned by Art Pope. Pope is North Carolina's budget director, and the Forward Together movement is picketing Pope-owned stores because of Pope's support for what the movement says is the extremist and regressive direction of North Carolina government policy. Pope has backed moves to deny Medicaid expansion to 500,000 people in North Carolina and to cut unemployment benefits for 170,000 people. The North Carolina NAACP also says Pope has been involved in voter suppression legislation and helped develop a budget with devastating cuts to public education. The NAACP says stores owned by Art Pope are in predominantly African-American, poor, and working-class communities. The picketing campaign wants to raise awareness of Pope's actions and demand a reversal of the policies that he supports. After 8 long years of struggle, graduate employees of New York University now have a neutrality agreement with NYU in a union election that will be held December 10th and 11th. NYU agrees to stay neutral in the union election and respect the results. 1,247 grad employees will be able to vote. If the United Auto Workers wins the election, collective bargaining rights for the grad student workers will be restored. A new contract could be in place by the end of the academic year. UAW Region 9A Director Julie Kushner says the tenacity of the workers over this 8-year struggle to win back their collective bargaining rights is inspiring, and the UAW is proud to have stood with the workers. The NYU grad student workers lost their collective bargaining rights after a decision by the George W. Bush-appointed National Labor Relations Board allowed NYU to refuse to bargain a second contract.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds... Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around, waiting for a promotion.
Well, you can tell this song's a little bit dated. Unemployment lines don't seem to have those anymore. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. No, we've pushed unemployment lines online and on the telephone, so we can't organize those people. We can't get them to come together. I believe that's by design. But, you know, you listen to the rhetoric. You know, here in Pennsylvania, we got a governor who, when he was running for election back in 2010, said, well, you know, they're just lazy. Those unemployed people, their jobs are, they're just too lazy to take them. And then we heard, well, they're drug addicts and all of that. They have substance abuse problems. That's why they can't find jobs. And you got to wonder, you know, if you've been long-term unemployed, and I know several people who have been jobless for years, not months, years. They can't seem to find full-time steady employment. What's it do to their psyche? What's it do to their self-image? What does it do to them as people? Here to help us answer some of the questions in a great book he's written, Flawed System, Flawed Self, I've got Ofer Sharon. He is an assistant professor of work and employment relations at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Ofer, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, good evening, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
You know, I look at this, you know, all of the finger-pointing and all of the anger put towards folks who are unemployed. Our governor, Tom Corbett, here in Pennsylvania said, you know, they're lazy. Or they're drug addicts, which is why they're not finding work. And I got to wonder, you know, what does that mean to people who have been long-term unemployed and have been seeking a job and unable to find it?
It's devastating because what happens with too many unemployed job seekers that I interviewed is they begin to believe it. They begin to feel like it's something that's their fault. And this is both as a result of this kind of stigma that you talked about that comes from our politicians, comes from sometimes the neighbors and sometimes employers, very often employers. It's also fundamental to the way people have to look for work and the experience that creates. And we have a highly personalized job search system in the United States. It relies a lot on networking and referrals and developing rapport, and this turn has very peculiar effect on the way people experience unemployment, which is devastating. It becomes a personal rejection. People often experience their difficulties in the labor market not as a result of the economy and all the larger forces that we know are making it so difficult to find a good job, but as something that is about them. And once you begin to feel that it's about you, it's very difficult to go forward and to continue job searching effectively.
Yeah, you know, I got to wonder, because most of the people I know, and maybe it's an American thing, maybe it's not. Maybe you'll be able to say if it's something, you know, specific to our country here in the U.S., because work is who we are. I mean, so many people I know, their identity is not who they are, but what they do. And I got to wonder how much of that assault on the self is wrapped up in, you know, I used to do this and that's who I was. That was my job. That was my person. That was me. And now it's not.
So I do think that in the United States, we deeply identify with our work, and this makes unemployment that much harder. But the psychological toll of unemployment really does vary, and not only because of this identification with work, but with how people interpret and understand why they're having difficulty finding a job. And this has to do with both the kind of system of hiring that we have, but also with the kind of support that's often made available to job seekers, which too often emphasizes only telling job seekers you are in control. If you only do the right steps, if you only network correctly and write the right kind of resume, you can be the master of your own economic fate.
Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen all the self-help books and all of the self-help tapes. And, oh, if you spend, you know, several hundred, most of it's a scam in my view. We'll write you the best resume ever. And, you know, and you're right. I mean, it's all of this what seems to be very commercial stuff.
Yeah, look, I don't think it's a scam, but I think, in fact, sometimes there's very valuable strategy about how to go about the job search that's being imparted, but I do think it's very limited in over-promising the degree of control and how much job seekers can make a difference in the outcomes by their own actions. And what happens is that if you get this message of it's all in your control and it's all about how you write the resume, you're really ill-equipped to then deal with what is increasingly a common experience of dealing with months, if not years, of not finding a job. When people experience that link of unemployment, they really need to have a wider understanding of the sociological forces at play so that they can remain resilient, so that they understand that it's not about them. And this is lacking currently in the kind of support and advice that we provide to job seekers, and something that I'm currently working on to try to figure out what is the best way we can support job seekers. And there are a whole bunch of very good coaches in Boston here who are working with me to try to develop a different way of supporting long-term unemployed job seekers so they don't blame themselves, so that they understand the larger picture, and yet they may also maintain the intensity of job searching that's necessary.
Yeah, and the other part of it is, you know, I have a friend who was an accountant for a number of years, and you know, he has taken in his view, and it's really been a shot to his ego that he's had to take a blue collar job, working in the trucking industry, and you know, he's making decent money. But that shot to self that he used to identify himself as, you know, white collar professional, and now he's a blue collar guy. So I guess the question I have is, in your studies of this, you know, what differences did you find between the white collar and blue collar workers and their strategies in looking for work?
Yeah. So first, I have to say that your friend who found a job as a trucking and making decent money is in some ways lucky, because I have seen many white collar job seekers come to terms with needing to switch careers and accepting other kinds of jobs, and not using what they were trained to do, but then not being able to actually get those kind of jobs, being told they're overqualified or simply they're not considered because they have been unemployed for too long. So there's even worse cases. But there is a big difference in the white-collar and the blue-collar job search world. I interviewed people in both of those economic sectors. And the, in the blue-collar case, which is very similar to the way hiring happens in Israel, which was the other place I did my study, there are very transparent and clear barriers to employment. The application process is very rigid. Often job seekers are told they need to do drug tests, their credit histories are reviewed. There are many arbitrary and rigid obstacles in their way, and this doesn't make unemployment any easier, but it becomes clear why they're not getting a job, and the external forces arrayed against them are clearly seen. In the white-collar American context, we have a peculiar situation where hiring happens through processes that are much more behind the scenes. They are much more dependent on networking, on people being able to develop relationships and rapport with others who will then refer them to a hiring manager, and then at the hiring manager interview, being able to establish a sense of connection, a fit.
Basically saying you're one of us.
Yes, yes. This is what I call the chemistry game that needs to be played in the white-collar context. It's peculiar. In the blue-collar context, the managers don't expect their workers to be one of them. They expect there to be a difference. And
don't want it, I would assume.
Exactly. Exactly. Someone like me is not going to be a good worker. They're going to want my job. So in the white-collar context, in this very peculiar game of getting hired where you have to create chemistry, there is a susceptibility then to understanding difficulties in getting hired as something about you, as not just about your skills or the labor market demand for particular types of work, but about your inability to create rapport, to network effectively, and then ultimately that there's something about you that comes across that people don't like. And this very toxic combination of long-term unemployment and this way of hiring creates a really high susceptibility to devastating self-blame, which then requires a particular kind of support, which we don't have. And this is, so we could think about this as we need to change the hiring system, which I would support, but I'm not optimistic we're going to have that happen anytime soon. But what I do think we could see in a shorter term is changing the support structure and how people are advised and supported during their periods of unemployment, and particularly in ways that minimize this self-blame, this feeling like it's all about you. We need to have more support that provides the tools to maintain resilience. I also think that having that more broad contextual understanding can have good political effects. I think we have the streets are too quiet. We have a huge crisis of unemployment right now, similar to the Great Depression, definitely at the level of long-term unemployment, and yet we don't see the same kind of political activity that would create the pressure for the state to do something. Right now, politicians and our policymakers can sit back and feel no pressure to take action. In fact, they're taking actions that are going to only make it worse by debating the cutting of food stamps, the cutting of extended unemployment benefits, et cetera, which are lifelines for people who have no other income.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent example. You go back through our history and you look at, you know, Coxey's army, for instance, you know, set up camp in Washington, D.C. For a month before MacArthur and Eisenhower came in with the military and burned their tents down and kicked them out of D.C. because they wanted jobs. They wanted, you think about the Bonus Army who, you know, because of the Depression, they were trying to be able to feed their family because there were no jobs. And you're right, we're not seeing enough people in the streets. I mean, over Thanksgiving, we saw some protests across the country and some organizing, which I think is fantastic, and I'm hoping to see a lot more. But I think you're absolutely right. And part of me believes that, you know, this is, know, when you close the unemployment offices, a big part of it. We pushed the unemployed, we pushed the people that we're talking about into the shadows and made it about them, as you pointed out in the book, Flawed System, Flawed Self. You can get it ofershirom.com, correct?
Yes. Or just Google the name of the book and you'll see it.
So let me ask you this. You say you want to, you know, change things. Are these things that we can do with changes in government policy? I look at Germany, for instance, when the big recession hit, they didn't allow a lot of people to be laid off. They cut the number of work hours down to, I think it was like 30 or 32, and then they had some policies that made up the additional income. So you didn't have huge layoffs and a huge brain drain. They had policies that stepped in and kind of fixed things or kind of helped buoy things up. Are the things you're talking about policy items, people items, what?
So I think Germany is an excellent example of where government policies can make a huge difference, and it exposes the fact that this is not inevitable. That yes, we live in a more globalized world with changing technologies that are creating pressures on all companies, but yet governments can play a very constructive role with instituting protective policies, just as you point out in Germany. We can also have much more of a social welfare state to provide a safety net for people who do fall out of employment. So I think we need to attack this problem in at multiple levels, including creating pressures for these government policies. But I also think that there is a role to play here for career coaches, career counselors, one-stop centers. We have a whole network of one-stop centers around the United States that is meant to be providing some kind of support to job seekers. And I don't think they're actually doing a great job when it comes to this group of long-term unemployed in maintaining the sense of understanding of the larger force of the place, to depersonalize the process, to understand that while they must, to have a chance to get a job, continue to play the game of job searching, that the reasons that they're not getting hired are not something about themselves, but something that is happening to millions of people. So too often what we have here is an invisible problem.
Right.
And job seekers themselves who are unemployed, they feel extremely isolated. The only event where they can meet other unemployed job seekers typically are networking events. And the rules of the game for a networking event is you put forward your best self. You're trying to get others to refer you, which does serve a useful purpose, but it doesn't provide a space where people can talk about their experience, can see that others are having the same experience, which would depersonalize it. This is the kind of support that we need to have available across the United States. And you know, this pilot study I'm doing now in Boston is trying to see how well we can diminish the sense of self-blame and then hopefully be able to replicate that across these one-stop centers.
You know, I've been saying for a while, and kind of, you know, this networking thing, that when the unemployment office is closed, we lost connection with unemployed folks, lost connection with each other, and maybe the referral system. You know, I go back to myself. You know, when I first got, you know, job years ago, the union hall was where I went. You know, that was the hiring hall. When job employers would come to the union and say, we need people to do this, and bang, you went out, and that's how the hiring process went. So, you know, I think about this changing of the hiring system. Part of me would like to go to, you know, a system where you have associations or guilds or unions or whatever, and that's where the hiring is done, and there's some kind of a movement between, you know, companies and workers, and, you know, be it white collar, blue collar, green collar, I don't care, but there's, you know, there's some way of having that middle ground. You talk about networking, and, you know, in this age of everything being online, as the unemployment centers have closed, everything's online. Has that made it easier to network or harder?
Well, there is the promise there that networking now should be very easy. It's just something we can do with a click on our computer. And what I'm hearing from job seekers is that, unfortunately, it's it doesn't work that easily. So they are, they have available to them now databases on websites like LinkedIn of many potential contacts. But to convert a potential contact into someone who will refer you still requires, in almost every case, like the meeting in person, developing the relationship, developing trust with the other person, that and making them want to refer you. This is a very difficult process, and the online networking piece of it, I think, simplifies one dimension of it, which is identifying who you may want to reach out to. You can see where they're working, but it by no means provides some kind of easy route to referral.
Last question I've got for you. You know, I know several people who've been unemployed for quite some time, and you know, the emergency unemployment ran, you know, their 26 weeks ran out, the federal emergency unemployment ran out, and now, you know, the odd job, this and that, but they're still plugging away. Any advice for folks who have been struggling, and any advice on you know, that you would give? I guess that would be the first part.
I guess my first piece of advice would be to try to find others who are in the same boat. To be able to sustain the search through what is an extremely difficult time. So doing it all alone makes it doubly hard to get through this period. And often families are not the ideal people to turn to. They're too invested. They have too much at stake to be able to provide the kind of support that's needed, the kind of empathy. Unfortunately, it doesn't often come. So I would look for others in the same boat. Sometimes there are organizations like this through churches or local community groups. Secondly, I would try as best I could to maintain a long horizon for this project of job searching, understanding that average duration of unemployment, of just how long it typically takes people to find work now, is much longer than it used to be. It's now 8 months, and people expect that they will find jobs in 2-3 months because that's actually what's been true for them for most of their lives.
Right.
So having more of an understanding of the labor market realities that we're in helps to depersonalize it and helps people, I think, going through this very, very difficult job search. I see job searching as the most difficult kind of work there is. It's actually trying to sell yourself and facing typically months and months of rejection. People who are in job searching are typically very tough, very resilient, but it takes a toll on almost everybody.
Yeah, and it's not the what we hear in our politics. Well, you're drug addicts, you're lazy, or any of that stuff. I mean, when you're looking
it
at a system,
could not be farther.
You're looking at a system where you've got five people looking for every one open job. Sorry, that doesn't fly for me. Again, Flawed System, Flawed Self, written by Ofer Sharon. OferSharon.com is where you go to get the book. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on his name. It'll take you right there. I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Rick. I enjoyed it.
All righty. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Coca-Cola is running a stealth advertising campaign. Stealth? Why would a corporation as ad-dependent as Coke spend big bucks on advertising that it doesn't want consumers to notice? Shh. Because the campaign is a surreptitious ploy to enlist restaurants in a marketing conspiracy that targets you, your children, and, of course, your wallet. Coke calls its covert gambit, Cap the Tap, urging restaurateurs to stop offering plain old tap water to customers. Quote, every time your business fills a cup or a glass with tap water, it pours potential profits down the drain. Cap the Tap can put a stop to that, says Coke, by teaching your crew members or waitstaff suggestive selling techniques to convert requests for tap water into orders for revenue-generating beverages. The program provides a guide for restaurant managers who would direct Coke's customer assault, a backroom poster to remind waitstaff, quote, when and how to suggestively sell beverages, and a participant's guide to put suggestive selling foremost in the mind as staff confronts the enemy. Customers. Tactics include outflanking those recalcitrant customers who insist on water. Just switch the sales pitch to bottled water. Remember, Coca-Cola owns Dasani, one of the top-selling brands of bottled water in the U.S. Early in its Cap the Tap scheme, the beverage behemoth offered two incentive programs for waitstaff, Suggest More and Score, and Get Your Fill. Both were competitions to spur servers to push more Coke on American restaurant goers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Coke's CEO has declared that, quote, obesity is today's most challenging health issue, and solving it requires all of us doing our part. Really? By selling more Coke? That's proof that hypocrisy is now the official rocket fuel of corporate profits. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. 'Cause the union's missing.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So today, back in 2009, and I remember it like it was yesterday, court documents filed in Boston claimed that Walmart Stores Incorporated, agreed to pay $40 million to 87,500 Massachusetts employees who claimed that they were cheated out of rest and meal breaks. Their time cards were manipulated, and they were refused pay for the overtime that they had performed. Just $40 million. And, you know, you add that to the other ones, you know, there are a number of other lawsuits where the same kind of stuff, wage theft. But it was today, back in 2009. So good news. Somebody won on some level. But I look at this, and, you know, again, you know, I thought it's an interesting book. In that, you know, for me, I've always been fascinated by how people, when you meet new people, or you go to dinner parties and stuff, it always comes up. One of the very first things, and maybe it's just as we don't have anything else to talk about, but one of the very first ones, so what do you do for a living? And when I generally throw something really stupid out, or, you know, something obnoxious, or just to get a rise out of people and see what kind of reaction they get. Especially when I was driving a truck for a living, you know. But I'm often interested in, you know, how people, it's who they are, and it's how we view ourselves. So it's not surprising to me on any level that once you lose your situation, so to speak, using a Christmas tale, an old Dickens line, once you lose your A Christmas Carol, once you lose your situation, it's a reflection of the self. It's a reflection of who you are. It's a shot at who you are. And I guess I'm a little different. I've never never really taken an identity in what I do for a living. What I do for a living is how I support my family. It's how I take care of my children. It's how I plan for my future. It's how we do things to get through our lives and enjoy our lives and enjoy being, around folks. So for me, what I do has very little bearing on who I am. And I remember at times when I was unemployed. Fortunately, I was never unemployed really long. There was only one time when I was really unemployed. I'd been laid off a couple of times, and you always knew that, once the economy picked back up, the jobs would come back and you'd be able to go back to work. But once I was, I was really unemployed. The trucking industry was just decimated because of deregulation, and it had really hit a hard point where, I'd worked for like three or four companies that just bang, 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 out of business. And it had, had everything to do with deregulation. And I go back and I thought about those times where it's because I was young enough to go, well, I can do anything. So I'm not tied to this one thing. And it gave me maybe a different view. But, I think of people who, make 10, 20 years at a job and bang, they're done. And that's who they were. I can't imagine waking up and going, myself is gone. Kind of a weird situation, which is why this book, Flawed System, Flawed Self, is worth the read. Now, we talked a little bit about Germany. As this was going on, I was advocating at the time for a system much like what the Germans, without knowing what they were doing, a system much because it makes sense. And I know. Policy that makes sense. Actually making sure that the economy works for everybody. Thinking about everyone, wow, there's a novel concept. We don't get that much, do we? We don't get that thought much. It's generally hooray for me, screw everybody else. And, as I said earlier, and as Brian emailed me and seconded my thought, I've always had good health care. I want to make sure everyone has that. I've been fortunate. I've always had a good, decent, union-paying job. I want that for everyone. And, I'm not the guy who's going to kick the ladder off the side of the building and make sure you don't get up. We should all be doing well. And I look at this, the New York Times had an infograph on the minimum wage, which, one of those things that caught my attention. As the top 1% of this country has just done exponentially better than everybody else in every way, shape, or form. People at the bottom of the economic scale, they've been getting screwed for so long. And we hear, the minimum wage workers, those are just those pimply-faced teenage kids get their first job. Well, we find out less than a quarter of minimum wage workers are teenagers. Less than a quarter. In fact, what we find is that nearly 4 in 10 are over the age of 30. Single parents, full with a child. And what they had looked at, what this graph had looked at as, a single parent working full time with one child to avoid poverty would need, now this is what they would need just to stay at the poverty line as it is. In 2013, they need $8.11. The minimum wage right now is 7.25. So just to be at poverty, just to be at the poverty level, they would need almost $1 an hour raise. What this infograph did is it took a look and said, had that minimum wage kept pace with the top 1%, had the minimum wage gone the same growth pattern as the top 1% in the country, it'd be over 30. It'd be $33. It'd be $33 an hour in 2007. Today, it would be $22.62 after the recession. It'd be 212% higher than the minimum wage is currently. And you think about this. As the 1% has just astronomical gains in their compensation, just through the roof, 212%. working people have actually seen their wages stagnate and go backwards. And I often cite the Emmanuel Sayers studies that showed in 2009-2010, of all the new income gains, 93% went to the top 1%. So that meant 7% was left for everybody else. And from 2009 to 2011, it was something like 121% went to the top 1%. You go, Rick, how's that possible? How's it possible they got 121%? Well, because they took from you. Wages went down. And this is a time where you're looking at productivity has just gone through the roof. I mean, had the minimum wage kept pace with productivity, they claim the minimum wage would be $21.72 an hour. Now, remember, these are the people who talk about a meritocracy. These are the people who talk about, hey, well, if you're more productive, you should make more money. Wrong. Productivity's up, minimum wage down. From 2000 to 2012, productivity went up by 25%. Wages actually went down. In fact, there are some economists right now who are saying that the first part of this 21st century, lost decade. And you got to start wondering, are we looking at the potential of a second lost decade? Or maybe even a lost century? Because you look at what's gone on. You look at this consolidation of power by these corporatists. Now, look at New Jersey, just passed a minimum wage hike, tied it to inflation. SeaTech Washington, they did as well, along with some paid sick days and some vacation language as well. Massachusetts and D.C., they're looking at it. You're seeing other states that are, you know, they're trying to, their campaigns going on. You know, Idaho, Illinois, there's some Maryland just to the south of us. You know, Alaska, I think, even has a campaign going on. And what are we doing? Well, here in Pennsylvania anyway, Seth Grove and his piece of legislation, he's got a bill that would make it illegal for local towns or municipalities or cities to pass paid sick day or paid vacation ordinances. You go, but Rick, you know, let's pass a minimum wage ordinance. Let's locally raise it. Can't. It's already illegal. They made it illegal the last time they raised the minimum wage. And I know, Rick. These are the people who believe in local, right? Wrong. Flat wrong. But I look at that number and I go, you know, what if we had a minimum wage that was $22 an hour? Which I got to be honest, to live in this society, to have any decent kind of standard of living, you need to make about that. To be able to participate in this economy, you need to make somewhere in that neighborhood. To raise a family, absolutely. And it's really just sad. You go back and you look at 1960, the minimum wage was 47% of the median wage of a full-time worker in this country. It's the 47%. It had actually jumped up to over 50% in the early 1960s, down to 37% of the median wage right now. So we're seeing this massive redistribution of wealth from people who work to people who shuffle money around, to people who invest, our capitalist class. Shame. Absolute shame. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Gotta find a way to hold it to account. People didn't find a way to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us?
Accountability. Wow, there's a word. There's a word without much meaning on Wall Street or in Washington. Ah, yes. Or even in Harrisburg for that matter. Accountability. Wow, you know what today is? Today's Ken Lay Day. That's right. Today is the day Enron filed for bankruptcy back in 2001. You think of all the people who got screwed out of their pensions. Think about it. And again, it's another one of those stories where the well-to-do remain well-to-do. Yeah, you think about all the bank runs, you think about all of the chaos of the countries throughout history, and you go, who gets screwed and who ends up doing okay? You think about the Enron situation where the executives, they got out. Their money was okay. Those workers who had pensions through the company where the company had said, well, we're going to give you stock. We're going to put all your eggs in our basket, which is one of the rules of investing, is at least as it was explained to me, is that you never invest where you work. You never buy the stock of the company that you work for. Because, hey, if the company goes broke, guess what happens? Not only do you lose your job, but you lose your retirement, too. So diversify. There are a lot of other companies you can invest in. You do that. Unless they're giving it to you. Now, if the company's giving you their stock and you're not buying it, that's a whole other ballgame. But if your retirement's tied up in the company you work for, I think Enron is the cautionary tale. I think when Lucent Technologies, you know, a guy I met, and I've told this story a bunch of times, but it bears repeating because it is the cautionary tale. Now, I used to meet this guy, you know, every couple of days. As I would stop at this Quick Check in New Jersey, and we would meet. You know, he'd have coffee, and we'd sit at the table, and we'd BS for a bit as he was off to his work, and I was finishing up my day driving. And, you know, trying to talk me to get into computers. And, I got the world by the short hairs. You know, I got this six-figure job, and I've got, you know, like $400,000 in my 401K, which is all tied up in company stock. And at the time, the stock was trading like $100 a share. And within a very quick, very short period of time, bang, down to $2 a share, being traded in huge volume, playing the pennies. And here this guy ended up losing his job. And the long, long story, very, very short, he actually had to replace the person that took his job from India. And the way he explained it, I had to actually crate up his computer, everything, and ship it back with this guy. Or he wasn't going to get a severance package. And, you know, he said, you know, and I'd seen him months down the road. His 401k was like $8,000 at the time. And just horrible situation. But you know what? The executives did okay, much like this Enron deal. They did okay. The workers, they couldn't change their pension at all. Nothing. And they lost most of it. So I look at this story from Illinois, and it's going to happen here. Look, one of the prime legislative pieces of the agenda is pension, quote-unquote, reform. And I love that. We're going to reform it. Yeah, we're going to reform it by stealing it. We're going to reform it by screwing it up. We're going to reform it by making sure it doesn't actually pay anything out and cost us twice as much. Yeah, that's well, Republican reform. Yeah, that's about right. Fits about right. And I look at Illinois, where I guess the piece of legislation that they put forth just dropped, I guess, today. 325 pages of it was dropped today. They're going to vote on it tomorrow, as I understand. Now, from what I've been reading on it, and look, I didn't read the 325 pages. You got to wonder if the legislature there in Illinois did either. According to the report that I've read, the plan is to increase retirement age, limit COLAs, and prohibit collective bargaining in the pension process. Prohibit the use of pension funds for retiree health care. You know, all the things we've gotten used to seeing corporate America doing. If you remember us talking about the whole Patriot Coal situation, you know, another one of those great examples of you know, corporations, you know, taking care of themselves. Now we're seeing, and I've been saying this for a while, this is not new. There are those who believe that we need to run government like ExxonMobil or like Enron, which means we can steal those people's pensions. And, sorry, you know, or we'll raise the retirement age till we raise it just around the time when you're gonna kick off. And good luck trying to get anything. Or we'll limit the COLA so that it's completely eaten away by inflation, so that you can't retire. And of course, we're going to take away your right to have any say in it whatsoever. That sounds about right, doesn't it? And of course, the big moneyed people are going to be pushing for it, because Wall Street really want to have all of this control and this power. And as I'm looking at this Illinois situation, I'm going, you know, Pennsylvania's going to do the same. They follow the same, you know, Alec style path. I have to think about Social Security, because to me, that's like the crown jewel for Wall Street. That's, you know, that's the Mona Lisa. I mean, that is the jewel. That's the gem. That's the creme de la creme. That is it. That's the cat's meow. It's the whole ball of wax. It's all of that, man. That would be mission accomplished. Break out the Bush banner, the sock in the drawers, the whole nine yards. If they could get a hold of it. And look, there are people, there are forces to fix the debt people, and all of these groups are saying, oh, we need to raise the retirement age, limit the COLAs, stop you from having any say, deal with Medicare. Gee, it sounds eerily familiar, doesn't it? Sounds kind of like, yeah, there's a plan here. The sad reality is that there's no plan that I'm seeing for us to defend it. There's no real plan yet, which is why I keep saying we need people in the streets. All we keep hearing, the message that the Alec types and the anti-worker types keep throwing out here, well, you know, I don't have a pension. Why should they? Screw those public sector workers. And those workers, they're just lazy. Yeah, the public sector, they don't do anything. Uh-huh. You keep believing that. It's not true. Oh, those evil unions, oh, they're bad. And so, you know, some all of the other things, you know, 401ks are better than, you know, better than pension plans. Oh, the pensions are too generous. You know, love that one. You're looking at like $18,000 to $24,000 a year for someone who's dedicated their entire life to public service. But that's too generous. And, you know, in reality, it is too generous. It's too generous to someone who has nothing, to someone who thanks to corporate America and thanks to our politicians who have done nothing to stop it, they have nothing. So when they look at somebody who has an $18,000 or $16,000 or whatever the pension amount is, they go, wow, that's too much because I don't have anything. And here again, for me, I go back to instead of destroying Social Security, we should be expanding it. We should be saying, hey, we know there's a retirement crisis coming very, very soon, and that we've allowed Wall Street to really muck this whole system up. We need to expand Social Security. We need to lower the age, not raise it, so that we get people out of the workforce, onto the next phase of their lives, so that the younger generation can then have those jobs to build their families. You know, it's called thinking about tomorrow and the economy and getting things moving. I know thinking forward, not something our Republican friends do much of, unless it's handed to them by a think tank or some shill front group. It just is what it is, folks. Unless you've got a better solution or a better idea on this. But I look at the pension situation. They keep saying, oh, an unfunded liability of $400 gazillion and the sky's falling and the end of the world's coming. Oh, my goodness. And look, there is a liability there. And that's going to be paid over the next, you know, generation and a half, too. Not right now, not today. The sky is not falling this moment. Are there things that we should be doing? Absolutely. Number one, creating an economy that works. Getting people back to work. Dealing with our unemployment problems. Dealing with the wage stagnation. Because you know the best thing for wage growth? A labor shortage. Getting people back to work. What don't companies want? A labor shortage. And I go back to the guy we interviewed here at the top of the hour. His book, Flawed System, Flawed Self. You know, these employers get away with the tactics that they get. Oh, well, you know, you're not one of us. Or, you know, jumping through all these hoops. They do it because they can. Because they have a lot of people vying for those jobs. And they're going to scrutinize and they're going to do all of this stuff. You know, to find, well, we got to find just the right one. Or it's just a matter of, you know, we like screwing with people. It's fun. And we can pay you next to nothing to do it. A tight labor market, you know, kind of like during the Clinton years, where McDonald's was paying $10 an hour. That's how you raise wages. You have a minimum wage that says, you know, we're going to be somewhere half of the median wage, somewhere around there, so that if you are at the bottom, you're not in poverty. See, because to me, if you're working 40 hours a week, I'm sorry, you shouldn't be anywhere near the poverty line. But what's coming? Understand, what's coming is this assault on all of our retirement security, especially that Social Security. I mean, that's really the prize there. And once they get their hands on that, and once they diminish that, what then happens? Do we see people in the streets? Do we see people organizing? Do we see people demanding politicians? Because look, I'm telling you, this is coming. They have all but told us directly, we're going to destroy these folks, their pension system. In fact, if Corbett could get his way, they would go retroactively and lower the pensions. And there's a lot of talk around, you know, multi-employer plans right now of doing some of those things, going back and retroactively change. Instead of saying, you know what, we should be securing those pension systems and increasing them. We're seeing people saying we need to destroy that. And that's part of what all this thing in Illinois is. And I'm going to be interested to see tomorrow if it passes. I got to wonder how many people read the 325 pages and understand. Illinois is a Democratic state. So this is bipartisan. When the moneyed interests shake their tin can, When the moneyed interests say jump, both parties know how high. When the Wall Streets and the big hedge fund people say we want, they already know how much. It all. And for me, I'm hoping at some point we push back from this messaging. You know, I talked earlier about you know, working on the conclusion of our the People's Tour for America book, which we haven't decided on a title yet. It's just the book that's coming out of the from our tour. But you know, this idea that as I was growing up, that unions meant a better life. The message that the big money people are saying is, no, they're the reason that your life's worse. And I remember that family and a number of other families like them throughout my life who, because they got that job and it paid a union wage, you could see it from afar that their lives got better. How do you get that message to people who are struggling to make ends meet and put food on the table? How do you get that? Well, it's got to be there for them to see. And this is why we're seeing the assault on organized labor right now, why we're seeing the assault by the big moneyed interests. Because, look, you're talking about 6.5%, maybe 7% of the private sector workforce are members of unions now. When I was a kid, it was in the 25-28% range. The unions were doing all kind of stuff. They, you know, the Police Athletic League sponsored the baseball league, the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, the teams. The Teamsters had a team. I think the electricians had a team. You had people who, they were part of the community. And now everything's this corporation or that corporation. And everything's got to be pandering to their needs and their interests. And what does that mean? Well, it means kiss your Social Security goodbye because, you know, like George Carlin said, they're going to get it because they're in the club. And you and I are not in the big club. Sad. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone, take the program on the go. You can email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you've got something on your mind, I do appreciate all of the communications. I got a quick email from Jane who said, love the program. Thanks for being here. And you're right. They're criminals. Yeah, I do say that. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Workers in 100 cities are expected to strike on Thursday. It's part of the National Fast Food Workers Movement that began in 2012 with workers at fast food restaurants in New York City walking off their jobs to demand better wages. Fast food workers in every region of the continental U.S. will walk off their jobs Thursday in the Fight for 15 movement, a demand for at least a $15 an hour minimum wage and the right to form unions without employer retaliation. Supporters of this fast food worker movement will also rally in 100 additional U.S. cities. Worker strikes will include McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and KFC. It's the latest chapter in the escalating low-wage worker struggle to win living wages and real union organizing rights nationwide. Fast for Families is a 21-day fast aimed at stressing the moral impacts of the Republican U.S. House leadership's failure to act on immigration reform. Fast for Families is supported by thousands of advocates and organizations. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama visited the Fast for Families tent of a national mall over the Thanksgiving weekend in a show of support. Three people have been on a fast for 21 days, and a three-day National Days of Act, Fast, and Pray event in solidarity with the Fast for Families began on Monday. A special event and press conference about the fasting is set for today in Washington, D.C. North Carolina's Forward Together Moral Movement is launching informational pickets at stores owned by Art Pope. Pope is North Carolina's budget director, and the Forward Together movement is picketing Pope-owned stores because of Pope's support for what the movement says is the extremist and regressive direction of North Carolina government policy. Pope has backed moves to deny Medicaid expansion to 500,000 people in North Carolina and to cut unemployment benefits for 170,000 people. The North Carolina NAACP also says Pope has been involved in voter suppression legislation and helped develop a budget with devastating cuts to public education. The NAACP says stores owned by Art Pope are in predominantly African-American, poor, and working-class communities. The picketing campaign wants to raise awareness of Pope's actions and demand a reversal of the policies that he supports. After 8 long years of struggle, graduate employees of New York University now have a neutrality agreement with NYU in a union election that will be held December 10th and 11th. NYU agrees to stay neutral in the union election and respect the results. 1,247 grad employees will be able to vote. If the United Auto Workers wins the election, collective bargaining rights for the grad student workers will be restored. A new contract could be in place by the end of the academic year. UAW Region 9A Director Julie Kushner says the tenacity of the workers over this 8-year struggle to win back their collective bargaining rights is inspiring, and the UAW is proud to have stood with the workers. The NYU grad student workers lost their collective bargaining rights after a decision by the George W. Bush-appointed National Labor Relations Board allowed NYU to refuse to bargain a second contract.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Carol sent me a note here during the break. It says Amazon is going to be delivering workers with drones, according to the... she says they might start sending packages delivering by drones. She said they're kind of cute looking, though. And if you look at the octocopter drone... evidently, they have little robot claws that pick up, scoop up packages, and can fly them right to your house. Scared yet? Start using drones to deliver packages to us. It's sad. Anyway, today was Cyber Monday. Hope you if you used your computer, your spyware was up to date. Hopefully, if you used a mobile app, you did so with caution. Disabled your Bluetooth. They say don't use the public wireless or public computers. Look for security symbols on sites. Know your online merchants and don't click on pop-up ads. Pretty much just your basic internet safety stuff. And, you know, even the companies that you know, you might want to think twice if you actually trust them or not. So beware. Anyway, I've got Amelia Deloney on the line. She is a senior policy director at the Center for Media Justice. They have put out a report, Consumers, Big Data, and Online Tracking in the Retail Industry, a case study of Walmart, here to help consumers protect themselves a little bit. Amelia, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, thank you.
I look at this, you know, this being Cyber Monday and all, and, you know, I'm thinking about people using their mobile devices in a place like Walmart. What kind of tracking could you get? Are we living in those sci-fi movies that I grew up with as a kid where they knew everything about you and custom tailored everything to your product needs?
You know, it's hard to know exactly what they know about us because they don't share all of those details. And certainly when most of us download an app and see the lengthy privacy in terms of conditions literature, we just click yes and want to get to the app and start using it. But it is true. I mean, a lot of stores, and Walmart is the one that we focus on, collects a ton of data on over 145 million Americans. course, for Walmart, it's all about customizing your shopping experience and being able to push items to us that they think that we will buy and therefore increase their bottom line. But at the same time, for the shoppers, you know, it collects a lot of information, what kind of operating system you have on your phone, where you live, how often you shop. At different times when it was attached to a wireless in the store, it could even track where you were in the store and how what aisles you were in and how much time you spent there. And, of course, all of this feeds into a big data machine that generates a profile that says a lot of stuff about who you are, some that you would like to share and some you might not.
Yeah, you got to wonder how many people actually think about what you just said, you know, because when the little store cards were coming out, when they were feeding us these store cards saying, oh, you can get these great discounts, here, fill out this application. And, you know, I would ask people, did you think about what you gave them? Did you think about the access to your personal life of everything that you consume, all of the food you eat, all of the products you buy? Who gets that data? Where does it go? What are they using it for? Do you think about that? And, you know, most people I know, well, you know, I don't care. We seem to be kind of complacent.
I think it's true. I mean, I think it goes back to, you know, the sayings that we all sort of grew up in our homes. You know, our grandmothers or our mothers told us that, you know, there's no such thing as free. And that's certainly the rules that we kind of live by nowadays, just reminding people that if you see a bargain that's too good to be true, it probably is. You know, you may not be paying X, Y, or Z in terms of cash for an item, but believe us, the stores are collecting data that's very profitable, and they're making up the difference in other ways.
So let's say Walmart or any company, you point out, Walmart has collected data on more than 145 million of us, more than 60% of the adults in this country. They don't collect this data just for themselves. What do they do with all of this information? What happens to it?
You know, there's these data warehouses, really, where the data is stored, and then there's a whole profiteering model that's based off the collection of this data. So it's packaged into what's called profiles, and then data centers or data distributors sell those profiles to all kinds of different, what we call, third parties. In the case of Walmart, I think they identified, you know, hundreds of third-party vendors that they actually packaged this data and sold it to. And this is happening all the time, you know, wherever you're shopping, you know, these different profiles are being created. Of course, this is nothing new. It happened with credit cards. It happened when magazines came to people's houses in the mail. But the fact that people, you know, are nearly inseparable from their cell phone or their mobile device or their iPad now means that the amount of data that's being captured and what's being captured, it just sort of far exceeds where we've been before.
Yeah, you know, we took the kids to Disneyland last Christmas, and I remember having this really heated conversation with a guy on the bus until my wife elbowed me about government and corporate interests and all of this. And we went through the turnstile at the Disney park, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but in order to get in with your ticket, you have to give them your thumbprint. So you put your thumbprint on this thing, and now they know that you, okay, you can take your card, go on through. And I remember turning to him and I say, well, let me ask you, had the IRS made you put your thumbprint on your tax return, what would you have done? And there's part of me that asked the question, you know, we would lose our ever-loving freaking minds if government collected this kind of data about us, and openly so. But when it comes to these private for-profit corporations, it doesn't seem to be as, maybe it's not in our thought process. And I think it should be, or I don't know. I'm curious what your thoughts.
It definitely should be, and I think, you know, the two are far more linked than people realize. You know, there is a lot of collusion and cooperation between private industry and government surveillance around the kind of data that's captured and sold. There's not a clear line between the two, like, oh, in this arena it's safe and in this arena it's not. I mean, there's a lot of gray area in the middle. You know, we're in a time when technology is just growing so rapidly that we don't really have clear privacy policies around how all of this information is stored and how it's used. You know, we've never been at a time in history before where you're creating an information trail about yourself that will never be deleted. No. So what you were doing at 15 and 16 and 21 and 35 may not be who you are at 60. But what do you do about all of that information? You know, and I think the other thing, or what we hear a lot from community members is sort of, you know, if I don't have anything to hide, I don't have anything to worry about. And what we're saying is the privacy and secrecy are different things. You know, that people have a right to their privacy, and we have to be very careful about the pictures that are being created about us through this data storage. Some of it's accurate, but a lot of it's not accurate, and it's really the inaccurate pieces or the accurate pieces that are used harm that are really challenging, and particularly for the communities that we work with, which are more vulnerable communities of color, low-income communities, there are some data stories that are being told about these communities that then lead to further issues and challenges in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, because as I understand, once something gets there, it's virtually impossible to make it go away.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if Walmart is kind of collecting all of this data about who you are at a certain age and what you were buying and how much money you were spending and what aisles you were in and, you know, are you looking at scales or are you looking at slim fast and what does that say about your health? You know, that they make some assumptions then about sort of your health and
right. Are
you trying to lose weight? What if you're shopping for X, Y, or Z? And what does that say about you? And, you know, there's countless stories about, you know, all kinds of information being leaked that's either accurate or inaccurate. But I think, you know, the bigger picture for folks who are kind of getting involved and having their eyes opened is to just sort of ask yourself, you know, how much information is too much and what sort of privacy protections should we be guaranteed? And really that's the place where we want to start is, you know, as consumers, as citizens in this country, we should have some basic expectations around privacy that should extend from our regular life into the digital life.
Do we have any of those? Are there any rules or are there any laws that dictate how the information collected? Because, you know, one of the first things that came up with the grocery store cards, I remember when those first came out, and I said, you know, eventually you'll see the grocery companies who have collected everything that you've purchased over, you know, over however many months, years, whatever. Somehow that information gets into the hands of insurance companies, and they say, well, sorry, you ate a lot of red meat, no health care for you. That heart attack, well, it was preventable because you ate. And part of me, you know, because that's how my mind works, thinks that at some point we see all of this stuff linking up. I mean, right now it seems like it's kind of disjointed. It's his mind, but I'll sell you some. But at some point, I think it all comes together, be it into the hands of a big company or government or something, and that's kind of concerning.
Oh, definitely. You know, and it's not just your own data. I mean, that's the interesting and part about data profiles is that they're really not about individual. They're about a community or a group of people. And so all of this data is being collected by about people all the time, you know, people who live in your same zip code, who are your same age, who graduated from your same school, who shopped at this store, who went to this website. And then complex mathematical algorithms are used, right? And these, you know, these algorithms look for patterns, and from these patterns they create profiles. And so even if you're doing your best to protect yourself, you have to, you know, think about all of the people around you and what kind of information is being shared about them, you know, who you're associating with, what is being told, you know, the bigger picture that's being created. And I think it's really in that place, moving away from the individual to the bigger picture, that we see a lot of harm and a really high potential for discrimination.
I guess I didn't ask the question earlier. Are there any laws, though? I mean, is there anything on the books right now that dictates how this stuff is used, who can use it, anything? Or is there anything that's being, you know, considered? Or is anyone pushing for any type of legislation to give consumers some rights?
Yes. I mean, there's definitely people who are working in Washington, D.C. with the Federal Trade Commission, with Congress, and with the Senate to look at different pieces, anything from preventing, you know, GPS tracking on people's cell phone bills to looking at different protections or extra protections for minors or children when they're being marketed different kinds of foods to looking at, you know, electronic privacy and consumer protections, demanding more transparency from corporations and from governments. And so there's a whole bunch of little pieces that are all moving together. But, you know, it's relatively new. And so even as you're kind of fighting for better standards, there's a whole education piece that people are engaging in as well.
Yeah, and so what should we be doing? What should the consumer be doing? I mean, because we see all of these things. I mean, you go on the website, and if you Google anything, before you know it, bang, every ad that you see is, hey, something along that line. It's amazing how they've done such a masterful job. I mean, the capitalists, really, they've really figured out how to pimp their goods. What advice do you give consumers?
Yeah, well, you know, we would direct people to our website or our partners who put out the report. So we're the Center for Media Justice, and we're at www.mediajustice.org. And we encourage people to download the report and really read it, you know, in bits and pieces. It's about 20 pages. You know, really educate yourself. You know, actually take the time to look at the different apps to download it to your phone, the different websites you visit. You know, stop and really read the privacy policy and the terms and conditions that most people just flash through. I think folks will be very surprised what kind of information is being captured about them, you know, and how the company discloses in these terms and conditions that they'll sell or share or keep the information into eternity. You know, get active in your local community. Find out where your local congressman or senator is on a certain privacy issue and make sure you follow that. But mostly just really exercise caution and understand, you know, this is the sort of new digital millennium that we're living in. So it's not so much about returning to the quote-unquote Stone Age, but it is thinking about how we can be wise consumers and wise advocates in this time and really fight for the protections that we all need.
Now, let me leave people with something to chew on before the break. What's the Walmart e-commerce goal? What is their online goal? What's their data goal?
Oh, you know, they want to create profiles that allow them to sell to people, you know, with a way that they can almost guarantee a purchase, you know, basically 24/7 seamlessly. You know, that's really what it's about. It's about pushing products out the door and into people's hands. And this belief that the more you know about who you're selling to, the more you can tailor the ads and the pushing in that direction.
Or as the title of in your piece says, every person, every product, connected. That
exactly.
That to me, that's just every person. Wow.
Yes.
And I don't doubt that they will do it.
Oh, they are doing it. You know, they are definitely doing it, even as, you know, we see some of the grossest sort of labor violations and all kinds of other things that are happening in their store. They're finding out all kinds of new ways to make themselves more money.
Well, think about this. You know, if they're doing this to the beloved consumer, imagine what they're doing to their workers.
Exactly.
Again, the piece, Consumers, Big Data, and Online Tracking in the Retail Industry, a case study of Walmart, written in part by the folks at the Center for Media Justice. Their website, centerformediajustice.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much, Amelia Deloney, Senior Policy Director at the Center for Media Justice. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to class.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Coca-Cola is running a stealth advertising campaign. Stealth? Why would a corporation as ad-dependent as Coke spend big bucks on advertising that it doesn't want consumers to notice? Shh. Because the campaign is a surreptitious ploy to enlist restaurants in a marketing conspiracy that targets you, your children, and, of course, your wallet. Coke calls its covert gambit Cap the Tap, urging restaurateurs to stop offering plain old tap water to customers.
Quote, every time your business fills a cup or a glass with tap water, it pours potential profits down the drain. Cap the tap can put a stop to that, says Coke, by teaching your crew members or wait staff suggestive selling techniques to convert requests for tap water into orders for revenue-generating beverages. The program provides a guide for restaurant managers who would direct Coke's customer assault, a backroom poster to remind wait staff, quote, when and how to suggestively sell beverages, and a participant's guide to put suggestive selling foremost in the mind as staff confronts the enemy, customers. Tactics include outflanking those recalcitrant customers who insist on water. Just switch the sales pitch to bottled water. Remember, Coca-Cola owns Dasani, one of the top-selling brands of bottled water in the U.S. Early in its Cap the Tap scheme, the beverage behemoth offered two incentive programs for waitstaff, Suggest More and Score, and Get Your Fill. Both were competitions to spur servers to push more Coke on American restaurant goers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Coke's CEO has declared that, quote, obesity is today's most challenging health issue, and solving it requires all of us doing our part. Really? By selling more Coke? That's proof that hypocrisy is now the official rocket fuel of corporate profits. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Latest criminate by race and hate.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. In the November 18th edition of the Psychology Science magazine, there was a study published that caught my attention. I read a couple of stories on it and actually spent a little time reading the article, which something I've kind of thought of over the years. The difference between, and there have been a number of studies on the difference between people who call themselves liberal and the people who call themselves conservatives and the groups that they tend to be drawn to. And this study, took a look, compared kind of, the differences between the Tea Party and the Occupy, groups. And what they found is that liberals tend to think that they're not, that they're different, that they're unique, that they don't have similarities with other liberals. And you know, I've had these conversations with a couple of my with a couple of radio friends who do kind of what I do, only maybe a little differently. That they tend to go. Think about one conversation. There's a website that I think Alternet does the top five list of things. And a couple of my liberal friends are, well, we don't want that. That's something, that's simple-minded sloganeering that only the conservatives would do. Cause we're superior to that. And that's where some of the knocks against people who call themselves liberal are kind of true. A little bit of snobby, a little bit of elitist, a little bit of, you know, we're not like that. We're better than that. And what this study is saying is, as they wrote in the piece, the inability of liberal Occupy Wall Street protesters to achieve consensus on vital issues ultimately contributed to the movement's failure to develop solidarity and enact political change. And then they looked at, you know, the Tea Party, who, you know, while all the people don't really agree, they had some political power. The study builds on a bunch of past research that takes a look at, you know, different political groups, like I said, they found that liberals tend to be more creative, prefer to be more unique, different, as opposed to conservatives who, well, they tend to be more, as the study says, conventional and better organized, but less open-minded, less intellectually curious, much easier to walk the line. And I think one of the knocks, and this is where, you know, one of the conversations I had recently went. Where I think one of the knocks that liberals don't want to get pigeonholed into is that, well, you know, the Tea Party, here's the line. Here's the talking point. You got to stick to this. Here's your marching orders. Go. And you talk to people who espouse to be conservative, and, you know, they can bang off the talking point. They can hit it. They bang. Minimum wage is only for teenagers. Then you throw out, well, wait a second. You know, less than a quarter of people who actually make minimum wage are teenagers. In fact, you know, almost 40% are people over 30. A lot of them, most of them, are with children. Well, it's going to cost jobs. Okay, well, the studies have shown that they don't. Businesses will move. Well, actually, the reverse was true in the place where in Oregon when Washington and Oregon went through their situation. When Oregon raised the minimum wage, they actually got jobs because people had disposable income. Talking point, got it. Actually, defending the talking point, not so much. And I think that's where liberals get into this, well, we want to be smarter. No, it's just a matter of actually doing your research and knowing what you're talking about, as opposed to spewing a talking point. I'm of the mindset that, you know, there are those, the elitists that get the name, that, you know, they don't want to be part of the crew. They want to be their own. And this is kind of what this study suggests, that, you know, the whole Occupy thing. And look, I was not involved in it. To a large extent. I know people who were, and I'm sure they have differing opinions, but, you know, part of me says, in having been around folks who, I want to do my thing. What the left never got is empire. We understand fiefdom. The left understands fiefdom really well. I got my little thing here. We got our three or four people, and we're in our group, and, you know, we're doing our thing. But we're not going to let anybody else in. As where the political right, where a lot of money is, and understand, it's, I think a lot of it has to do with the cash. When there are piles of cash to be had, I think it's a little easier to get people to conform and to walk in line. But even still, you see on the right the issues that they espouse, very conformist, even though they want freedom. Very march in line, follow the rules, and not really be curious about what it is you're pushing. Now, this study, what they came up with is, I guess, you know, not really a surprise in that, you know, liberals tend to have a desire to be unique. They don't want to be conformists, as where conservatives, they, according to the study and according to my own viewpoint, that they're okay walking in a straight line. They're okay being like everybody else. Now, is that because of how the groups have interacted in the past? Is that because, you know, who knows? But this is just what an interesting, one of those interesting studies that you go, well, I'm glad somebody wrote it. Don't know that it's going to change the world, but it may make us think. And for me, I'm of the mindset that right is right, wrong is wrong. And if you give people facts, they're going to do what's right. I believe people are going to do what's right. Beyond your political ideology, beyond your party affiliation, unless you're just soulless. Like, I'm of the mindset that if you work, you shouldn't be in poverty. And I know a lot of conservatives who agree with that. I know a lot of conservatives who agree and believe that people should have access to good quality, affordable health care. Now, the question, we can have differences on how you get to that place, but they agree. I find conservatives, and these are these conversations that you have, you know, over a beer or something, where, you know, workers should have safe working conditions. People should have a voice in where they work. But we won't call it unions. No, no, we'll have the church do it. People believe that nobody in this country should be hungry. These are universal rights, in my view. Not in the rights of you, I have a right to remain silent, but the right thing. There should be no one hungry. There should be no one homeless. The right thing. And again, I go back to, unless you're soulless. unless you just don't really care about anyone but yourself. And I guess you see that too. But that's on both sides of the political ideology. More so on the conservative side. But I look at this study, and for some it may open eyes. For some it may go, oh, yeah, you know, that sounds about right. But for me, it solidifies my view of my long-held view. I guess it just is what it is. But hopefully, you know, in the coming weeks and months, because there are so many things that need to be addressed. And I just, you know, I feel that we're at this moment in history where we better figure out how to communicate and do it quickly. Some of the best conversations and best debates I've had are with people I fundamentally disagree with. But you know what I find very interesting? You can generally come to some common ground. You can generally do that. I wonder why our elected officials can't. And I have to wonder, is it the money? I have to wonder, is it the corporate power? Is it the influence of the wealth class's money and the lobbyists and all of that that go into it? Kind of seems like common sense there to me. Anyway, going to take a quick break, right back. When we come back, we're talking with Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Workers in 100 cities are expected to strike on Thursday. It's part of the National Fast Food Workers Movement that began in 2012 with workers at fast food restaurants in New York City walking off their jobs to demand better wages. Fast food workers in every region of the continental U.S. will walk off their jobs Thursday in the Fight for 15 movement, a demand for at least a $15 an hour minimum wage and the right to form unions, without employer retaliation. Supporters of this fast food worker movement will also rally in 100 additional U.S. cities. Worker strikes will include McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and KFC. It's the latest chapter in the escalating low-wage worker struggle to win living wages and real union organizing rights nationwide. Fast for Families is a 21-day fast aimed at stressing the moral impacts of the Republican U.S. House leadership's failure to act on immigration reform. Fast for Families is supported by thousands of advocates and organizations. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama visited the Fast for Families tent on the National Mall over the Thanksgiving weekend in a show of support. Three people have been on a fast for 21 days, and a three-day National Days of Act, Fast, and Pray event in solidarity with the Fast for Families began on Monday. A special event and press conference about the fasting is set for today in Washington, D.C. North Carolina's Forward Together Moral Movement is launching informational pickets at stores owned by Art Pope. Pope is North Carolina's budget director, and the Forward Together movement is picketing Pope-owned stores because of Pope's support for what the movement says is the extremist and regressive direction of North Carolina government policy. Pope has backed moves to deny Medicaid expansion to 500,000 people in North Carolina and to cut unemployment benefits for 170,000 people. The North Carolina NAACP also says Pope has been involved in voter suppression legislation and helped develop a budget with devastating cuts to public education. The NAACP says stores owned by Art Pope are in predominantly African-American, poor, and working-class communities. The picketing campaign wants to raise awareness of Pope's actions and demand a reversal of the policies that he supports. After 8 long years of struggle, graduate employees of New York University now have a neutrality agreement with NYU in a union election that will be held December 10th and 11th. NYU agrees to stay neutral in the union election and respect the results.
1,247 grad employees will be able to vote. If the United Auto Workers wins the election, collective bargaining rights for the grad student workers will be restored. A new contract could be in place by the end of the academic year. UAW Region 9A Director Julie Kushner says the tenacity of the workers over this eight-year struggle to win back their collective bargaining rights is inspiring, and the UAW is proud to have stood with the workers. The NYU grad student workers lost their collective bargaining rights after a decision by the George W. Bush-appointed National Labor Relations Board allowed NYU to refuse to bargain a second contract.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So if 40-year-old Paul Walker, the Fast and Furious star, killed in the car crash on Saturday, what caught my attention, and look, you know, when famous people die, it's sad, and you move on. But what grabbed me are the videos. People took videos of the burning car. What I didn't see, I don't think I saw anybody running to help. Got the video, though. Uploaded it to YouTube. Got our shares. Sad, sad, sad stuff. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. It's Dr. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So did you see this? Did you see these videos of this actor?
I couldn't watch anything like that.
It's just sad. I mean, they're taking videos and worried about things blowing up, but nobody ran to, I don't know, just...
Could they have saved him?
Who knows? I don't know. The car was on fire, and nobody went over to even, from the videos that I saw, nobody even went over to look. So it was, you know,
Wow.
Here again, you don't know, but, you know, and it's easy to, I guess, sit here and say I would have done, and I've gone up and tried to help in the past. I'm sure I probably would have tried. Who knows? It's just a sad, sad thing. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in the big city there. I see Gina McCarthy, EPA administrator, going to be going to China soon.
Well, yes. First of all, the vice president is in China as we speak, and this has to do with the disputed land. You know, I don't know if you remember, I think it was Time magazine or one of those magazines did a piece, and they said the next world war might be over this, and they showed a little island that was owned by China, or supposedly owned by China, but I think the Japanese are, anyhow, there is this, the Chinese have now said nobody can fly over it. So that's one piece, and that's what the vice president is doing. But then the EPA administrator, Gina McCarthy, she's also going to China, and the United States and China is, of course, responsible for doing a lot of bad emissions, particularly around mercury, things like that. But she also said they want support, as they say, for air pollution challenges, but China pollutes more than any other country. They have 1.3 billion citizens. And then apparently they use a lot of diesel fuel, and they don't use other things, and they really don't deal with pollution. And as you know, some people in China have, because their factories, you know, their factories are like where we were 60 years ago.
Yep. Well, I've heard that before. I mean, there were, and kind of their argument against any regulation on them is, hey, you know, you got away with it. You did it. Why can't we?
Right. Exactly. And you did it for so long, and we have 1.3 billion people, and what are we going to do?
Yeah. And, you know, I got to be honest, you know, you look at today, 1970, where the EPA was first established, the job-killing organization, as Michelle Bachmann says. I look at this, and I go back to, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland during the 70s. With the horrible
air. With those stacks downtown?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking
blowing
about.
Blowing black smoke?
Yep. As a kid, I suffered from a horrible asthma. And you hear the doctors now look back and go, well, it was, you know, because of the air quality. This was pre-Clean Air and Clean Water Act, mind you. So I would say that...
before the Cuyahoga caught on fire, though.
Well, the Cuyahoga caught on fire before I was born. That happened years ago.
Yeah, I know. It wasn't... I remember it.
That was... Okay, well... but, you know, that could have been, honestly, in the defense of Cleveland, that could have been anywhere in this country where you allowed industry to spew.
That's true.
Without doing anything to clean it up, without doing anything to stop a disaster from happening. It just happened in Cleveland, and from what I've told, what I've been told, is it had happened in a number of other places. They were just able to contain it quicker, and it didn't grow as large, but it did happen in other places. In fact, I've had people tell me that Bethlehem Steel in Bethlehem, where the the Lehigh River goes through, that actually caught on fire at some point.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, but a very small one. But, you know, we're looking at China and you go, how are you going to compete with them if they're, you know, they're where we were in the 50s and we're trying to, it seems to be a race to the bottom where either we've got to decide if we're going to live like that or we've got to figure out how to get them to move forward.
Well, that's right. And somehow they have to understand that if they manage to pollute all the area and pollute the world, they're not going to have a citizenship.
Don't care.
Or a country.
It's about business. It's about profit.
Well, they want to compete with the United States.
Yeah. Well, speaking of China Incorporated, did you make it out on Thursday or did you go shopping on Thursday?
I went on Friday.
Oh, okay. They're saying China Incorporated that didn't do as well as they thought they would on Thursday.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't notice.
Yeah, well, they said that, you know, the numbers of it were actually down from last year, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Well, I was in Macy's at about 5:30 Friday morning, and it was very busy. But, you know, I think people come to stores like that. It's the largest department store in the world. People are in for the Macy's parade. Yeah. They want to see it. That kind of thing.
You know, you were there. Good for you. I actually watched the repeat on TV. That's as close to a store as I got watching the parade.
You did? Oh, my God.
In repeat. I didn't watch it, the original.
I didn't even know they did a repeat.
Yeah, well, and where my mother-in-law lives, evidently they play it, and then they played it again. So we caught the very end of it and then watched a couple minutes of the beginning of it before football came on. So there, that was that.
Wow. Wow. Well, it'll be interesting because China doesn't seem to care about the environment.
Well, they care about, you know, they're capitalists. And I love that they're communists. No, they're capitalists. They figured out the game. If they can externalize all the costs on us, because if you look at the west coast of our country, a lot of people are complaining, hey, that stuff's coming our way. We should figure out how to stop it, which I find kind of ironic, since California has some of the cleanest, greenest laws in the country, that they're the ones who basically infected because of what was going on in China.
Well, the problem is that, right, the air and the currents come on over.
So,
and that's the dilemma.
So I understand Congress is going to be back, next week or tomorrow?
Congress will be back. Well, no, the House is back now, and they're voting actually as we speak. I can actually, you know, there's this white light, and we can actually see
don't,
it.
Don't go near it. Don't go near the white light. Stay away from the light.
And I can't see it right now.
I need you to finish this segment.
Right, okay. But I'm trying to see if... Oh, yes, they are voting as we speak, and the white light is still on.
All right. I know the House is only in session for eight days this month.
Right, the House is... The Senate comes back next week, and they really have a short schedule.
Yeah.
And remember, the 12th is when they're supposed to come up with a budget deal.
Yeah, the grand bargain or the big plan or whatever calling it now.
Right, becoming more and more reduced.
Yeah. When I look at this 113th Congress, the least productive ever, and by huge numbers. I think it was something like they passed like 50-some bills, and the do-nothing Congress of the Truman years passed like something like 400.
Yeah.
So is there any chance of them getting this deal done? I mean, because if they don't...
There's always a chance, but it's not probable. They have to do something, but of course I said that last time, and then they shut down the government.
Because if they don't get it done, what, January 15th, we're in another government shutdown mode?
That's right.
Yay. Still don't have the farm bill done, right? So end of the year...
The farm bill is not done. I mean, we've got nothing done.
So end of the year, we're going to see families who are struggling to put food on the table. Merry Christmas, we're stealing that away, right? Coal? Not even coal.
That's right.
As I understand, unemployment benefits are going to be taken away because they expire at the end of the year.
Well, no, not all unemployment benefits.
Some of them.
But they wanted to extend
the extended parts.
Right.
You know, the state-based unemployment fund, sure, that stays around because it's state-based, but the federal funding for it goes away for the extensions. The TAA money for displaced workers, that goes away, right?
All of that. Bye-bye.
Yeah. And still no farm bill. And that's the one that
right.
I guess gets me the most because...
And the farm bill is very important to a lot of America.
Exactly. I mean, I'm looking at this and you go, we're coming up to Christmas, all of this goodwill and all of this, you know, love thy neighbor, all of this, you know, we care about Jesus and all of this. And, oh, by the way, we're going to literally steal food out of the mouths of children.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what we're doing.
I got it. It's just as long as I was on the right.
No. That's exactly what we're doing, unfortunately.
And they're going to work 8 days in the whole month. Okay. All right. And we're still going to pay them. All right. I get it. I don't like it, but I get it.
So now the question is, what do we get this government to do by Christmas, where you have all of these families waiting, farm families, people on unemployment waiting to have a holiday with their family?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I just throw up my hands and go, you know, at some point we the voters have got to wake up and get rid of these people who are holding this country back. And, you know, I saw Candy Crowley asked Dianne Feinstein, I don't know if you saw this, if she thought that, you know, as a country we were safer. And Feinstein said no and went into a whole bunch of stuff. And then Mike Rogers, the chairman of the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, basically parroted the same thing. And, you know, I look at this and you have all of this division, all of this stuff going on. And, of course, there's a defense bill that's probably not going to get passed by the end of the year either. And you got to kind of wonder, while they're bickering amongst each other, how many threats are we allowing to go by? How many things are crumbling? How much of our infrastructure is being destroyed? You know, while they're doing this petty bickering, where do we as a nation end up?
That's another good question. I don't know the answer to that either.
Yeah.
So
what else is going on in the world?
Okay, we have the two China issues, as you know, that's a big issue with the Vice President being over there. Also, the immigration people, the Fasters, the people that President Obama went to see the other day, they went into the House tonight, and they went into the House chamber upstairs, obviously not on the floor. The Democrats clapped for them. The Republicans looked the other way.
Oh, they didn't boo?
They didn't boo.
They didn't taunt them with a sandwich?
They just looked the other way. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services today had another one of their calls. They said that these 834 transmissions, in other words, those are areas that their forms that they send to consumers, all that kind of stuff, are actually been fixed. They said that most of the bugs have been fixed, but that there is now a problem. Apparently there was a problem with displaying Social Security numbers. They said they fixed most of the things that from midnight to noon, this was today basically, they received 375,000 visitors. That's about twice what the website usually gets on a Monday. So Cyber Monday was obviously also important to healthcare.gov.
Ah, good. I mean, you got people who are going to go to it because, look, you know, here starting at the beginning of the year, people are going to need healthcare, and I'm not as hung up on things didn't work right from the start. We get it fixed, we get it moved forward, we tweak what you have to, and you fix what needs to be done, and you get people the coverage that they need. It's that simple. And as I said earlier in the program, you know, had the Republicans really cared about cancellations, because all we're hearing about is, oh, there are these people and they're getting the cancellation notices. What about the 41,000 low-wage workers here in Pennsylvania that Governor Corbett gave a cancellation notice to when he kicked all of those people off of adult basic. What about the Wisconsin folks when Walker closed Badger Care? What about the Ohio people when Buckeye Care got axed? What about all of these Republican governors who sent cancellation notices to low-wage workers when they stole their health care away? I don't remember seeing many Republicans crying tears then.
Well, because they don't cry.
Okay.
Well. I mean, that's the problem, right?
Yeah, I guess you're on your own, brother. Hooray for me, and well, screw everybody else.
Not I mean, it's very unfortunate what we're seeing happen in this country. And until they begin to somehow, until we can un-gerrymander the districts and people feel the pain from their constituents, it's not going to change.
That's why I'm hoping that someday we'll wake up and hopefully we vote the bums out. Maybe 2014 is the year. That's a good New Year's resolution. Something I can hope that may come true. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too, our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Coca-Cola is running a stealth advertising campaign. Stealth? Why would a corporation as ad-dependent as Coke spend big bucks on advertising that it doesn't want consumers to notice? Shh. Because the campaign is a surreptitious ploy to enlist restaurants in a marketing conspiracy that targets you, your children, and, of course, your wallet. Coke calls its covert gambit, Cap the Tap, urging restaurateurs to stop offering plain old tap water to customers. Quote, every time your business fills a cup or a glass with tap water, it pours potential profits down the drain. Cap the Tap can put a stop to that, says Coke, by teaching your crew members or waitstaff suggestive selling techniques to convert requests for tap water into orders for revenue-generating beverages. The program provides a guide for restaurant managers who would direct Coke's customer assault, a backroom poster to remind waitstaff, quote, when and how to suggestively sell beverages, and a participant's guide to put suggestive selling foremost in the mind as staff confronts the enemy. Customers. Tactics include outflanking those recalcitrant customers who insist on water. Just switch the sales pitch to bottled water. Remember, Coca-Cola owns Dasani, one of the top-selling brands of bottled water in the U.S. Early in its Cap the Tap scheme, the beverage behemoth offered two incentive programs for waitstaff, Suggest More and Score, and Get Your Fill. Both were competitions to spur servers to push more Coke on American restaurant goers. This is Jim Hightower saying, Coke's CEO has declared that, quote, obesity is today's most challenging health issue, and solving it requires all of us doing our part. Really? By selling more Coke? That's proof that hypocrisy is now the official rocket fuel of corporate profits. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do?
Back to the Rick Smith Show. We have the website, therickSmithShow.com. So it was the Circle of Hope Church in Philadelphia, according to the city paper, who threw out, asked to leave, didn't throw out, asked them to leave. Evidently, there was a guy who's going to church quite often there at the Circle of Hope, a gay man. Evidently, he had begun participating in some activities to say, you know what, we would like to have equal rights, please. And they have, well, they've asked him to leave. According to the guy, he said he was drawn to the church because they had a social justice message and that they had a conscience. And he claims he even told the leader of the church that he was gay when they first met. But things changed after Center City's annual Outfest in 2009 when he claims he was asked why the church wasn't listed as one of the friendly churches. And the founder and senior pastor said that we don't want to be divided up by gay political activism. He said, Mr. White said that you are not in covenant with us, certainly not enough to resist promoting a divisive issue that we've been successfully avoiding. So they've asked him to leave. And you go, well, okay, to me, I'm of the mindset, it's fine. But it does make you wonder. It does make you wonder what the religious folk actually doth believe. Read an interesting piece by a guy named Jonathan Mosley. He published this over at World Net Daily, where he wrote, "Jesus Christ is weeping in heaven, hearing Christians espouse a socialist philosophy that has created suffering and poverty around the world." Mr. Mosley says it is impossible to love one's neighbor as yourself without fighting against socialism, meaning government meddling in private lives. See, because Jesus was an anti-government guy. He was out there crusading against the man. And, you know, if you read, Mr. Mosley's piece, which I got to say I did, he takes, and I guess this is a lot of the religious folks who use the Bible as the basis of some weird ideology. I don't know that you could make a fundamental argument that Jesus was a capitalist. I don't think he would be all that thrilled by what went on Thursday and Friday. I don't think he would be thrilled at the stabbings and the shootings and the tasering, which I got to be honest, I did find quite comical. Like I said, it speaks volumes about me. But, you know, the beatings and the clubbings and the nasty nature that the time seems to bring out. Now, this guy writes and he says, you know, it's those people. He says, in one verse, we see that God rejects the left-wing Jesus Christ supported socialism, heresy. He said, when Jesus was asked to support redistribution of wealth, to tell one brother to share the family's inheritance with another, Jesus refused. And, you know, I remember, oddly enough, I do remember this from my days of being beaten in Catholic school, where if you look at the quote that, you know, he pulls out, where he says, you know, Jesus replied, because, you know, someone in the crowd says, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus replied, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? So that meant that Jesus evidently was okay with it not being split up or not being involved. His argument's quite unclear at this point. But if you go through and you read the rest of it, because I love how they take pieces and bits and parts. If you read through the rest of it, he goes on to talk about, you know, how you have to watch out and be on guard against greed, and, you know, life, you know, does not consist of abundance possessions and all of this stuff. And basically saying, you know, look, you know, if you hoard this stuff, what good is it going to do you? You know, if you have a surplus of crops and you tear down your barns to build bigger ones so you can store it, you know, what's that going to mean? And, you know, for me, that seems to be kind of a, you know, you should just be doing the right thing. You shouldn't need me or government to be part of it. So, you know, as I'm looking at this article, I'm thinking, you know, the farm bill isn't going to be passed. Well, we're literally thinking of taking food out of the mouths of children. And here this guy's saying, you know, Jesus would be that stingy capitalist. Very strange. I suggest you go and take a look at it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. See you back here tomorrow.
listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com.